it's Jeff Blair, host of the new podcast, Writer's Block. If you're hearing this via your primetime sports feed, follow the link in the show description to subscribe to Writer's Block for more great sports talk and interviews from myself, Richard Deitch, and Stephen Brunt. Writer's Block, sharp takes, not hot takes. Thanks.
Rewriting afternoon sports radio, one word at a time. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Man, there's nothing worse when they come on and you haven't even finished your pre-show lollipop, eh?
What was the flavor that you had? Anything good?
Yeah, it's Tootsie Pop. They're always good. Cherry.
Cherry.
Yeah.
I like it.
Guilty pleasure. It's Halloween, baby. My favorite holiday. It's Writer's Block with Blair and Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. There's nothing to talk about today. Game 7 of the World Series. Dwayne Casey returns home.
Leafs.
Caps. Leafs. Alex. Dwayne Casey, of course, fired as Raptors head coach before the start of last season, coming into the city at the same time that another head coach is on the hot seat.
It's interesting that to me, I don't know how you feel about this, but the Casey story feels, I know it's all in like real time or in actual time. It's not so far ago, but it feels like a lifetime ago. Like like the Dwayne Casey, like, was he salty about not getting enough credit for building the Raptors? That feels like a story that happened a million years ago, just given everything that happened last year with the championship. But interesting to see him back in town. I don't know what the Pistons are right now. I think he's a good coach, but if you're Casey, and I like Casey a lot, there has to be a part of you, Jeff, that's like, man, if I could have been here with Kawhi.
Well, that's
the same exact thing.
Look, that's the thing. I'm always conflicted talking about Dwayne because he's actually one of my favorite people that I've covered covering sports in this city. And I don't pretend to know all the ins and outs of the decision, obviously. You'd have to be something less than a human being if you weren't a little pissed off that it didn't happen to your watch. But at the same time, it's not the first, I'm going to call it a slight of Dwayne Casey's career. I don't necessarily consider it a slight. And I think, a realistic look at what the Raptors are and a realistic look at what was accomplished on his watch. I mean, he clearly laid the foundation for what happened. I mean, let's put it this way. If DeMar DeRozan doesn't become the player he became under Dwayne Casey, you're not trading for Kawhi Leonard. Now, right. I understand that that's really sort of working on revisionist history, but a lot of the good things about the Raptors come from Dwayne Casey. And as far as I can tell, the one thing that didn't happen on his watch is he didn't have Kawhi. And I'm not taking anything away from Nick Nurse, but just as the Golden State Warriors didn't have Klay and Kevin Durant, and Dwayne Casey didn't have Nick Nurse, or didn't have Kawhi Leonard. And again, that's stating the obvious. It's got nothing to do with somebody being less of a coach or anything. But hopefully, I imagine Dwayne Casey will get a nice response in the crowd tonight. He did the last time he was here. And Dwayne Casey's always he's had kind of a special spot in this city. And, I think back to when John Farrell knifed the Blue Jays in the back. I mean, it was a time where the city, was going through all sorts of issues with the Leafs. Toronto FC had not yet established themselves as, a team capable of winning a championship. Dwayne Casey was kind of the island of stability in terms of the city's coaching ranks. He was a guy who talked up Toronto. He was a guy, and Dwayne's got a political bent to him, as a lot of African Americans of his age do, because of what they had to go through. He was a guy that helped create the environment, that helped make Toronto and the Raptors, I guess, a little more approachable for a lot of American players. So he does deserve a tremendous amount of respect. There's no doubt about it. And I'm one of these people. I think there's room for everybody, man, on the Raptors. And, Brian Colangelo gets some credit, too. Like, there's room for everybody to get some credit for what happened here.
Yeah, the one thing, first of all, it's worth pointing out, just as sort of a point of order, like I totally thought Masai made a huge mistake when he fired
Casey. I did too.
Said it on the show. And
I didn't like the way it was handled. I thought it was cheap.
I was totally wrong. I thought absolutely got scapegoated for what happened against the Cavs. Obviously, a really horrible ending to that. But it in my opinion, back then, I thought Masai had totally discounted what happened during the regular season. The change in culture, which is really important, what Casey did. But, you know, again, Masai turned out to have made the, you know, at the end of the day, if you win, it's a great move by Masai. But, Jeff, what I think Dwayne Casey absolutely has to get credit for is, to me, he changed the defensive culture, defensive tenacity of the Raptors. He made them a very defensive-oriented group.
He gave them some balls is what he did.
Yeah, and he was, and even if the roster composition is different now, those who remain from the Casey era got a certain amount of, I thought, defensive toughness under Dwayne that started there. And maybe, and clearly Masai Ujiri thought so, you needed more of an offensive-minded coach or somebody who was a little more creative offensively to take the team to the next level. But the reality is, and this is like the you know, the absolute example in terms of how good you are as a coach really depends on your players. Look at Steve Kerr this year, Jeff. The Steve Kerr has rightfully earned like the mantle or tag of being a great coach and a great players coach, and the Warriors dynasty is what it is. That team right now looks like one of the worst teams in the Western Conference. Same coach. I don't think Steve Kerr's gotten dumber, but his players have gotten significantly worse. And so you do wonder, and I think you're right. I think it's totally human nature, if you're Dwayne Casey, to wonder, what could I have done with this roster if I had Kawhi Leonard and Danny Green there?
So that's the one story tonight. Toronto FC is in Atlanta. They'll take on Atlanta United. Rob Stone of Fox, host of the MLS on Fox, joins us at 3:25 to break that down. LA FC lost last night to the Seattle Sounders. So if Toronto wins, it sets up a rematch of the final. It would be the third time, I believe, Toronto FC's played the Seattle Sounders in the final. Did they lose to Seattle in that? Yeah. So it'll be the third time they played Seattle in the final. That game will be in Seattle because of the better record. And, of course, TFC has to beat Atlanta to get there, which isn't going to be easy because Atlanta's a very tough team. Nonetheless, they are playing tonight, and the World Series will be decided, as we predicted yesterday. The Washington Nationals putting the boots to the Houston Astros.
That was such a great game to watch.
It was. You know what? I was at the Leafs game last night, and I was watching a bit of the game on TV, and then I listened to it. And I got home in time to see the end of the game, and then to see the post game news conferences on MLB Network, because I wanted to see Joe Torre explain the rules. And you know, it's funny. I haven't seen Joe on a public stage or doing anything really public for the past couple of years. He's still got the same. There is a Joe Torre body language he had as a manager. There was body language that says, you can ask me anything you want because I'm on my game today. Like, you can ask me anything about anything, and I'm going to pontificate, and it's going to be great, and your notebook's going to be full. And then there's the, Jesus, I'd rather be any place other than this Joe Torre.
And that was last night.
Well, yes. When Joe Torre walks in carrying the rule book and the pages are folded, I'm going, we got an issue here. But, I mean, what a great game. It has everything that people hate about baseball in it and everything that people love about baseball.
Right.
That's why baseball, last night's game is why baseball will never, ever, ever, ever become popular again. Because I can see why people hated what happened. I can see why people like me absolutely loved it. I loved everything about the call. The fact that that you can appeal this, you can't appeal that, you can't appeal this judgment call, but the referee can get on the headset, or the umpire can get in the headset, right, just to make sure he understands the rule right. And just, of course, the whole thing with Dave Martinez and then Dave Martinez, God bless him, after the game, basically saying, you know me, I don't like to say anything bad about umpires. Dave, you practically, yeah. you,
it was like
you,
WWE.
Wanted to, you wanted to kill the guy.
Basically, yeah. I haven't seen a manager like get that mad in a while. The thing
interesting factoid, by the way, 8 managers have been ejected from World Series games. He's the first manager to be ejected in a win.
Really? That's a great stat.
That is a stat. That's courtesy, by the way, of our friend Dan Shulman.
That's a great, who had a really good tweet last night that
Shulman's
jumped on and I retweeted you.
Yeah.
The thing, like, I am one, Jeff, who I actually like video in sports. I'm willing to deal with the weight, sort of breaking up the flow if you get the right call. That said, last night, like you, that is why I love baseball, because that play becomes such a great conversation topic to talk about forever.
It was the right call about a bad rule.
I agree.
It was the right call on a bad rule.
Exactly.
And, you know, I'd really love, we'll have Justin Morneau, a former first baseman, on later. I would love to have gotten Cliff Floyd on today to talk about this, because I cover the game where Cliff Floyd's career essentially ended, almost ended in that play. It didn't. But
a similar, like, ball when
he broke 18 bones in his hand playing first base. He basically spent his off season in a metal cast. All his fingers were metal rods going through all his fingers.
Ugh.
And they referred to it. Mark DeRose actually referred to it in MLB Network and said, he said, we all remember that play. Everybody in baseball remember that play, because it was Gil Heredia fielding a ball, tossing it. It was ball glove. And I think it was Greg Jeffries, ball glove. No, it wasn't. It was Todd Hundley, ball glove base runner at the same time. And his hand, it just exploded. I mean, it went like that. It just absolutely exploded. So there's a reason the rule is the way it is. But as I said, that's a classic baseball example. Correct interpretation of a truly horse bleep rule.
Yeah, and they got bailed out big time because Rendon hit that homer. Had the Astros won that game in a close manner, really bad moment for baseball.
I was thinking back to 85, I think it was 85, Kansas City and St. Louis. Don Denkinger blows a call at first base. Kansas City goes on to win that game. They go on to win the World Series. And That of course was before video review,
right?
But it was just it is. There are calls that are made that, you know, people say it's the worst call I've ever seen. That's the worst call I've ever seen.
Well, that changed the fate of a World Series.
It changed the fate of a World Series.
Yeah. George Org, was that some right?
I'm
trying to remember who was first.
I don't remember who it was. Yeah. George. No, it'd be George Order, if anybody. Okay. It was Dane Orge walked it off.
Right. Okay.
But it would be George.
But
Org.
Yeah, that might be the. I mean, we'd have to go down the list, but that has to be at the top of the biggest blown calls in baseball history.
Yeah. Right? So anyhow, and this probably would have been if, you don't know. It's not like that. It's not like somebody would have had to do something after that for it, you know, to not. There was enough time left in the game.
Right.
This stuff was going to happen.
It certainly is a
great talking point.
The other thing I wanted to bring up to you about that game, which was fascinating, that was a big talking point. At the end of the game, obviously, Verducci interviewed Steven Strasburg. Was Strasburg going in after the first inning, talking, I think, to his pitching coach.
Paul Manhard, yeah.
Yeah, who noticed that he was tipping pitches.
I got to get the guy's name. They have a video coordinator.
Who
noticed it and said.
That is such an.
And actually told Manhard between innings, he's doing it again.
Right.
And of course, that also ties into the whole thing. Everybody in baseball suspects that there's something untoward going on with the Houston Astros.
Right. Yeah. I love to. If you happen to be online, check out Tom Verducci of Sports Illustrated's story on this. He has a really in-depth story. But I found that so fascinating that they were able to diagnose that. And Strasburg obviously turned his pitching performance around. But that's exactly what I was talking about, Jeff, is once again, the shadow of the Houston Astros perhaps using technology to get its advantage.
The Red Sox. Oh, I see what you mean. Because the Red Sox have been accused of doing that as well. I mean, every team in baseball, when stuff like that happens, the Red Sox have believed that the Toronto Blue Jays have had a camera in center field stealing signs for 15 years.
But he pitched.
All you have to do is look at how good the Red Sox have played the Blue Jays here, and you know that would pretty much put the lie to anything.
What an outing, though, by Strasburg.
That's great.
That's an all-time great outing.
He's going down as one of the best postseason pitchers of the era, without question.
And your stat yesterday that you dropped from Verducci about Justin Verlander, totally...
It's a lot of pitches that
totally
he's
played
year.
Out. He's 0-6 now.
Yeah, a lot of pitches.
Unbelievable.
I don't know
0-6 in the World
is.
Series for one of the great pitchers of his era.
The other talking point, too, that was kind of fun was the whole carrying the bat thing after Bregman hit the home run.
That made me laugh. I thought
and
that
then
was
Soto carried the home run. And the great thing is, you know, after the game, Bregman apologizes and says, that's not me, you know, and then Dave Martinez says he's going to talk to Juan Soto about it. That's not us. Come on. A.J. Hinch said, yeah, Alex Bregman shouldn't have done it, but neither should Soto. And Soto was kind of the only guy who said, and he just said, hey, I thought it looked cool.
Yeah. Why the no fun police there?
Well, I don't know if it's no fun police. I have no problem pimping a home run. Like, I have no problem dropping the bat and doing that.
It makes the game fun, right?
I'm not a fan of carrying your bat down to the base. It's probably never a good thing for a...
You think that's more showing up than the Batista?
I would be worried about something happening with a dude running with a bat, to be honest. I'd be worried about the ball hitting the bat.
Oh, okay. I didn't think about
that. That's a home run, so yeah. It's not going to happen. But I'd just be worried about... Stuff happens when emotion takes over.
And you got a bat. Yeah, I get it.
Right?
John,
you know, Roseboro.
Yeah.
So, but no. I mean, I certainly did. I would, if you want to do it and the other team wants to do it, that's fine. I'm not going to get bent out of shape. But I got to admit, when I first saw it, my first reaction was, wow, that really is not a Bregman thing to do.
Yeah, and I understand.
And I was wondering about that.
Yeah, I understand why he apologized, because it's really out of his character.
Yeah.
But as a sort of a, to me, as a general thesis, I like more emotion in baseball, to me, is a good thing. And even if it's a little bit
the only thing I'd say
chippy
is that's not really...
Trashed. It's sort of like optic trash talking,
not,
right?
You know what? Yeah, because it's not... There's no emotion there.
Well,
I mean,
you know, Soto had emotion when he was trying to sort of...
No, you carrying the bat isn't as much emotion as what Jose Bautista showed,
well, yeah,
flipping the bat away.
I agree with that. Yeah. I like it. I want guys to show their personality. Although, you know, Bregman said that's not his personality.
He
did what he did.
It's not something that I'm going to get upset about. I mean, guys can do it. Guys can do it. I just, as I said, I generally don't like the idea of people running around the field carrying a bat, because it has led to bad stuff happening.
For sure.
And it's great if everybody's on board with it. Not so good if the guy at first base takes offense and decks you or tries to deck you.
Or the pitcher yells something at you and you got a bat in your hand. I agree. That's where it gets bad.
But anyhow, it's great talking points from the game.
Sets up a great... I'm so excited for game 7.
And it's all hands on deck. And it's Zach Greinke. There may not be a better opportunity. I don't know if any individual pitcher in the history of baseball has had a better opportunity to change the talking points around him.
Oh, his career than Zach Greinke.
Than Zach Greinke does tonight.
Well, if Zach Greinke wins game seven,
he'll
just always be remembered for this.
He goes in that elite group. Maybe Clayton Kershaw's, Clayton Kershaw needs this type of thing. He needs this type of thing to burnish his repertoire. Agreed. Zach Greinke needs the type of thing as well. And he needs his team to win, because I got to tell you, if Zach Greinke pitches well and they lose, it ain't going to matter. You got to pitch well in this situation and you got to win.
I know,
it's going to be great. All hands on deck. Yeah. You know, the tanks are going to be empty. Pick your cliche. It's going to be fantastic.
Again, understanding they are different pitchers, different eras, et cetera. But there are so many guys, Jeff, who have won World Series games or pitched big in World Series games where that becomes your defining thought about them. I feel like Andy Pettit is a perfect example of a guy who probably reputationally is thought of higher because of how he pitched in the postseason.
Well, everybody in that Yankees team, those Yankees teams are like the 67 Maple Leafs. I mean, the number of guys from the 67 Maple Leafs who are in the Hall of Fame and probably don't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, but are in there because they're on the 67 Maple Leafs. Those Yankees teams are kind of like that.
Yeah. I
agree with you and Pettit. Big game pitcher, absolutely. Right. Although, as Verducci pointed out, and again, this is why Verducci's so great, because he covered all those Yankees teams, so that's kind of his point of reference. He made and I covered this game, and I'd forgotten about Andy Pettit getting his tits lit up in a game.
He did.
And it was the same thing. He was tipping pitches.
Yep.
And the Arizona Diamondbacks had his pitches, and they didn't get around to changing it. But anyway, I was as I said, that is why...
Yeah, you're right about Greinke, though. If he wins tonight, like, the dominant storyline of his career becomes tonight, I think. And you think of him totally differently.
Completely.
I mean, you think of him as a good pitcher.
Completely.
I think whatever the line between good and great, he starts moving up if he wins
completely
tonight. Yeah.
Completely. And
I think he might. I totally flipped. I thought the Astros were absolutely good. I thought they were going to actually blow him out last night.
I was totally wrong.
And now I think it's a coin flip game.
I got no idea who's going to win this game. I'm not making any prediction. We're actually watching the MLB Network's replaying the game, and Max Scherzer is up in the bullpen. That's what it comes down to. Is Dave Martinez
What is left? What does he have left?
Well, and he's got Patrick Corbin. He's again.
You want to talk about Scherzer? What do you think he has left?
Oh,
in one
I have
game?
No idea.
I mean, yeah, I feel like impossible. If you got three innings out of him, wouldn't you consider that a win?
I don't know. I don't know how healthy the guy is. That's impossible to tell.
Yeah. Patrick Corbin on short rest could still be effective.
Strasburg will pitch tonight, too, if they have to as well. That's so, true. I mean, they'll empty.
And they didn't use their bullpen yesterday, so they have.
Well, they used
Doolittle.
They used Doolittle, but that's. Yeah,
so you'd have Hudson, you'd have some other guys.
For a game seven, both of these teams are fairly well set up because you know that Gerrit Cole will come out of the bullpen for the Astros. So it should be a good game, but I have no idea what's going to happen. You know, it's a World Series where there haven't been any close games for the most part, and the road team is dominated.
That
blows me away.
Yeah, I know, and I know what your answer was the other day. I'm curious if you've changed at all. If the Nationals end up winning this series, winning two games on the road in Houston after giving up three losses in Washington, does it change your perception legacy-wise of the Astros? You said the other day that because they've won...
No, well, it depends. This isn't...
Because I think almost if they lose it in this manner, I think historically they...
Nah, because you know what?
You think a little differently.
I mean, the Red Sox came back against the Yankees, right? And people still like those Yankees teams.
Oh, the 4-0, the 3-0 one?
I don't. It depends on what they do for a follow-up act. If they win the World Series, then
I agree with you.
It's their mulligan almost. But I will say this for Davey Martinez we're led to believe he was 48 hours away from being fired. And you go from that to winning the World Series.
Yeah. Not to mention his health issues. That guy's had crazy run.
Anyhow.
Yeah, I have to be honest. The first thing I thought about when Fox came back from, I was watching the Fox, I've come back from commercial show, Davey Martinez, was like, dude, you just had like some serious heart issues. Like, what are you doing?
Well, yeah, but I mean, you wouldn't be out there. You wouldn't be out there.
I get it. He's competitive guy.
We'll be joined, as I mentioned, by Justin Morneau in the 4 o'clock hour. We got some stuff to give away in the show as well. Buck Martinez, who had the call of the game last night, will be along. It'll be fascinating to get Buck Martinez's take on the incidents in the game. But we're going to take a little break when we come back. Luke Moore is co-host of the Football Ramble Daily podcast. Now, it's an interesting podcast. It's three guys in the UK who put together a soccer podcast. People put together podcasts. That happens, right? And for some reason, soccer, more than any other sport, seems to have developed a real culture of podcasts. Their podcast has grown to the point where they're taking it international. They've got a show in Toronto, a live show in Toronto on November 7th at the Danforth. They've got a live show in New York City. So it's a podcast, and they go around the country in the UK, and they're bringing it over to North America. It's a cool story. They're funny guys. Luke Moore is co-host of the Football Ramble Daily podcast. He'll join us. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and 360. 439, oh, 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 Pizza Nova.
439, oh, 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 Pizza Nova. Ciao, I'm Dominic Rimucci. Halloween is a great time of year to throw a party for your friends and family. And what would be better than a delicious, mouth-watering pizza made with your favorite toppings and oven-baked to perfection? From my family to yours, have a safe and happy Halloween.
439-444-PIZZA-NOVA. Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Travis McKenzie's like just a chatterbox in here, Deitch.
Giving us a chapter and verse.
Wow.
Right, Travis now he's doing the walk of shame back to the production studio.
The walk of shame. And now he's like beavering away. He's trying to remember who's
soccer guest. I'm excited.
Yeah, you sounded almost. As I mentioned, Buck Martinez joins us at 3, Rob Stone at 3:25, Justin Morneau at 4:25. Chris Johnson joins us. We'll talk about the Leafs and what happened last night in their loss to the Washington Capitals, 4-3 in overtime. Some questionable coaching decisions by Mike Babcock in that game. We'll talk to CJ about that. See that? I've outlined them. This is how questionable they were.
Your handwriting.
I went to the game.
Unbelievably.
I write. I'm that guy. I can still write cursive.
Yeah, I was just gonna say like that. That honestly looks like cursive. Something from like an 1840s diary.
No,
that's a compliment.
Considering like I was born in 1853.
Your handwriting is extraordinarily impressive.
Anyhow,
wow.
I take a lot of notes. I have to keep notes on people I hate and stuff like that. I've got a long.
I don't even want to see what it looks like for me.
It's huge. You're
short.
Deitch. Let's see.
Brunt chapter. You love Brunt.
You're like four pages. That's okay.
That's not bad.
Actually, one of my big fears is I lost that. I called it my little book of hate, and I lost it one time.
Great title for a book, buddy.
It is, little book of hate, and I lost it one time.
Especially if you make it in the size of like a small book.
It was like a little moleskin. Yeah. And it was just like random notifications with things like, skull and crossbones next to
you. You may actually have like a, you may want to patent that. That could be like a serious idea.
Great idea.
Yeah, it's not bad, actually.
Like some guys had little black books back in the day, and they had little logos besides the names in there. And I just had like nasty logos, like knives and skulls and crossbones and things like that.
Little Book of Hate also sounds like a really good like Broadway show, too.
It would be.
Good title. I don't know how it works.
Little Book of Mormon. Same thing.
Try to patent that if you can.
Little Book of Hate. Little Book of Mormon.
It flows off the tongue.
Well, you guess in a manner of speaking, it does. So we got a guy here at Sportsnet named Amal Dellet, who produces podcasts. He's a freaking genius. I mean, he worked in a podcast that Brent and I did. He's one of the brightest people that I've run into. And he loves soccer like me. And he loves podcasts like me. So last year, I was telling him that I had a routine. I had like the Sky Footy podcast. I had Guardian Football Weekly because I subscribed to the Guardian. All this stuff. He said, "Hey, have you heard of Football Ramble?" And I thought, "No, I haven't." He said, "You got to listen to Football Ramble because it's right up your alley. It's the type of thing you would do if you could do a soccer podcast." So I automatically assume there's F-bombs every third or fourth word. Generally, it's only every 12th word. So I started listening to it, and I'm hooked. It's the podcast is Football Ramble, and it's coming to Toronto. They're doing a live podcast in town on Thursday, November 7th at the Danforth Music Hall. If you've ever, everybody here has been to the Danforth Music Hall. It's like my favorite, it's my favorite location for shows or anything in Toronto. It's just fabulous. They're also doing a show in New York City. And they do, as is the case with a lot of football, a lot of soccer podcasts in the UK, they also, they basically make road trips. And as I said, there is, for some reason, soccer has a really well-developed culture of really, really smart podcasts. I think basketball is probably the only sport in North America that can match it for just really, really smart podcasts. Yeah. Luke Moore is co-host of the Football Ramble Daily Podcast, and he joins Richard Deitch and myself in Writer's Block. Luke, thanks so much for joining us today. Pleasure to speak to you. I feel like saying, long-time listener, first-time caller, because that's basically what I am.
Good afternoon to you, both. Thank you very much for having me on, and what a fantastic introduction. I couldn't have asked for any more. Thank you.
I'll do it again at Danforth if you want for beer. I do work sure. for beer. I do work for beer, believe me.
We all do.
I'll be the guy wearing the Charlton Athletic jersey. I'll be the only person in Toronto wearing the Charlton Athletic jersey.
So you reckon you're the only Charlton Athletic fan in the whole of Toronto?
Probably, maybe the only Charlton Athletic fan outside of the UK. Hey, tell us about the. I was talking a little bit about the culture of soccer podcasts in the UK because it's people listen to them, people make money off them, they're marketed. Tell us how Football Ramble came about.
Football Ramble came about because myself and three of my pals back in about 2007, 2008 decided that we'd like to just get together and chat about football every couple of weeks because we used to do some university radio back in the day. And then we got together, started doing it, recorded it around an old-fashioned mini disc player in my kitchen. And then just stuck at it and just enjoyed it and kept doing it. And then it went weekly and now it's gone daily. And we picked up a few listeners along the way and it just kind of started from there, really. We've been doing it for almost 12 years now.
Luke, for those who have not listened to the podcast, how would you describe the podcast stylistically, content-wise?
I think it's quite uproarious, quite fun. I would describe it as an entertainment show about football rather than a football show. We've got our F-bombs down to one every kind of eight words now. So very similar to what you guys were saying earlier. But it's a bit of fun. I mean, I can't remember who it was who said it, but someone once said football is the most important of the least important things. And so we kind of try and take that attitude into the show and have a bit of fun with it. If you're looking for something that's really serious and something that kind of takes the game very serious and is very earnest, then you are not going to find that with us. We like to have fun with it and make fun of the whole thing and the whole circus around the game and the sport that we love and have an awful lot of fun doing it.
Now, it's interesting because you guys are coming over here at a time where the Toronto FC could be in the MLS championship, depending on what happens tonight. But I know one of the talking points as well around football in the UK in particular after this past weekend was VAR, video assisted refereeing.
Yeah.
We're also coming over at a time where Game 6 of the World Series just concluded with basically, you know, and again, this is kind of a real baseball thing, but in addition to the result, in addition to Washington beating Houston, there was one of those fabulous baseball situations where we had a correct call made using a horrible rule that basically saw a manager ejected and almost caused a mini riot. And, you know, we talked a little bit about this because I understand the argument and the debate around the use of VAR in soccer, because I'm one of these people that thinks that once you open the door to video review, you can't close it. And that we're seeing that in baseball now, where the argument is, okay, we're allowing it for some things, we're not allowing it in judgment calls. It doesn't make sense. Where do you draw the line? And I'm just wondering how concerned you are about that. And is that an issue, or is it just simply kind of a talking point right now that will eventually be resolved?
Oh, it's a big issue here. The chairman of the 20 Premier League clubs, I believe, met this week to discuss VAR and the rollout of it in the Premier League this season. You'll be hard pushed to find anyone that's been particularly happy about how it's gone so far. And isn't it interesting that we live in this time where the advent of all this technology that kind of touches every part of our lives without us even realizing it, and it's taken it touching our most important sports and our most popular sports for us to really get up in arms about it and really think about it. It's a really fascinating time. I think you get on, you chat to players, and the majority of players I've spoken to are in favor of it because they say, look, I don't care about the philosophical debate about it or what should or shouldn't be happening. As far as I'm concerned, I work hard on my career and I work hard all week and I want the decision to be right. But then you kind of have the other guys who say, well, I'm not really sure that it's necessary. I mean, referees get 98% of decisions right anyway. I mean, and a lot of the decisions come down to the interpretation of the referee on the field and how he wants to referee the flow of the game and the type of game it is. And one referee will interpret the laws differently from week to week. So it's a big old mess at the moment, really, and I don't know how it's going to resolve itself.
Luke, you mentioned that you like to have fun on the show, so I'll give you a fun topic that I think happened either yesterday or the day before. Did you have
fun, Meisters?
Yes. Did you happen to see Diego Maradona sitting on a throne coaching at Newell's Old Boys? That is, Diego Maradona to me is just among the more fascinating people on earth for many reasons. But that was like that was spectacular in the annals of Diego Maradona sort of conversation pieces.
Yeah, he's an incredible character, isn't he? I mean, there was when he took over, he's at Gimnasia, isn't he? I think when he took over in his press conference at the start of his tenure there, one of the first things he said was, "I promise you, I'll never miss a day of training." And then he missed training the next day. And it's kind of like most coaches don't really need to say that. They just do it because they realize it's part of the job. He's an absolute character. I mean, I remember reading a book about South American football a few years ago saying that there's a church of Diego Maradona in Argentina.
Yep.
And it's got about 200,000 parishioners. I mean, the guy is living in a completely different world to the rest of us. It's insane what goes on the circus around Maradona. I can also remember when he was coaching the Argentinian national team in 2010 at the World Cup. And there was a bit of footage of him taking training for a team that had serious designs on going quite far in the competition, and the footage was him with a cigar on the go,
yes,
just taking free kicks and kicking the ball at people's asses. It was just crazy. So the man is insane. He's a law unto himself. We talk about him quite a lot on our live show, actually. We do a little bit about his life and what he's up to. And as part of our kind of comedy routine, we do do a bit on El Diego.
Luke, tell us about the idea behind taking a podcast live, because it a lot of people do it. We've tried it. We've done one. There's an art to pulling it off, I think, to say the least. You guys have done it for a while now, and tell us a bit about what that involves, and also just coming over to North America, which seems to be a pretty bold move.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, coming over to the US and Canada is massive for us, and I think we're the first UK football show to do it, and we're very proud to do so. We can't wait to get cracking. We're in the middle of our UK tour at the moment, so we've got another show tomorrow night, one on Friday, one on Saturday, and then we fly out on Monday. And I think I can't speak on behalf of what other shows do, but we try and turn ours into a full-blown entertainment kind of theatre show. So I don't know if people are taking me seriously when I tell them this, but I promise you this is true. There are kind of audience interaction games. There are sing-songs. There are dances. There are all sorts of different bits and pieces. We basically took the attitude when we planned the show for this tour that any amount of time we can spend not in our seats behind the table is good time. So we try and keep it interesting, try and get up and down and do different bits and pieces and really keep it fast-paced and funny. And we're trying to make it more... Where I said that the podcast is an entertainment show about football, we try and make the live show a comedy show about football and to keep it entertaining, because we found that, like, people are paying money to come out and they could be doing anything on a Thursday night or whatever it is. They could be going to the cinema, the movies, they could be going to a sporting event. They've chosen to pay to come out and see us. So we've got to try and keep them entertained and get them laughing, and that's what we're trying to do.
The other thing you've done as well, which I think is genius, is you understand that there are people who are going to your shows solo. So it's not like you've got a Tinder. It's not like it's a Tinder app for soccer fans. But essentially, there's a way, if you're going to a show solo, for you to meet other people who are going to the show solo and have some drinks, which is genius, because it's part of the family thing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So if you want to come out, if you're listening to this now and you fancy coming along to our Toronto show, but you think maybe some of your friends won't be interested or you might have to come on your own, get at us on Twitter, @FootballRamble. Let us know. We'll retweet it. We'll put you in touch with other people based in Toronto that want to come along. And you can meet up with them and have a beer beforehand or afterwards or whatever. We'll come try and find you afterwards as well and have a beer with you too. Make it a real kind of community event, because it's awful when people want to go and do something, but they don't want to do it on their own. I mean, I love going to the movies on my own or going to do things on my own. It can be a great thing, and it's a great way of meeting new people. So we're all about that as well, for sure.
Hey, Luke, it was great of you to do this. Thanks so much. I look forward to seeing you guys on Thursday. Safe travels.
Thanks, Luke.
Thanks very much. Thanks
Take
a lot
care.
For your time, and I'll speak to you soon.
Absolutely. Luke Moore is co-host of the Football Ramble Daily podcast. You can follow him on Twitter @LukeAaronMoore. And it is fun. They also do... They do as part of their schedule, they'll do a podcast on the greatest games in soccer history, and they'll basically talk to people or they'll chat about the game. So it's really ambitious, and like I said, as Luke said, a bunch of guys, college guys, who sat around, had fun doing this, and said, "God, I bet someone will pay us to do this."
Yeah, Luke, he just cut a good promo for that. That actually would make me interested in what these guys are all about. I wonder if they do anything for the Canadian audience or North America. Like, do they talk about MLS at all just because they happen to be here?
I don't know. You know, it's funny because I went to see Bill Maher when he came through Toronto a couple of years ago. And, of course, Bill Maher does the whole thing with Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, right, and how fat he is, right? And this is when Rob Ford was mayor of Toronto. So I'm thinking Bill Maher is going to – I'm going because I think he's going to say something outrageous about Rob Ford. Doesn't mention him. Like, you know, talk about not understanding your local audience. But it's great because he was doing a Chris Christie thing, and all you could hear, there were people in the audience yelling, "Have you seen our mayor? Have you seen?" And he had no idea what anybody was going on about. So, yeah, having a little tip.
Yeah, a little local flair is always smart.
Is good. We appreciate Luke Moore joining us again. FootballRamble.com. Ticketmaster in North America is where you can go. It's Football Ramble, Thursday, November 7th, 7 p.m. at the Danforth Music Hall. It's going to be a good time. There'll be lots of beer, lots of football talk, and apparently there may even be dancers. So what's not to like about that? It's Writer's Block with Blair and Deitch on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and 360. Need a leg up in your picks? Oddshark.net is your source for the latest odds from leading authorities, expert editorial content, and detailed matchup picks. Looking for statistics and trends for an upcoming game? Oddshark.net has those too, and it's free. Expert in-depth analysis, stats, numbers, and trends to help you make the sharp game day picks, whether you want to get it on the football action, tonight's hockey game, or anything in between. Go to oddshark.net. This is not a gambling site.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
A reminder, by the way, you can go to ramblelive.com for tickets as well to Football Ramble.
That was good. I like that guest. That guy.
They're fun.
I bet you that. I'm going to check that out. I bet that podcast sounds like it'd be really fun.
Yeah, it's.
And you know, Jeff, because you're a soccer person, the soccer sort of podcast world, especially in North America and the States, has exploded.
The Men
in Blazers guys have basically.
Yeah.
They started as a podcast, and then NBC ended up putting them on network television.
They started out as a podcast first and then went to TV.
Correct.
Okay.
So they really hit it out of the park. They started as a podcast. They did live shows like these guys did, and then NBC took their podcast, created a studio for them, and now they have, not in addition to the audio podcast, they have like a television arm to it. So, like, you know, there are people who have made probably seven figures just from a great podcast idea developing into multimedia.
Yeah, and a reminder, by the way, and as we were talking to Luke Moore, I'm reminded that a Writer's Block is also available on podcast, and as indeed all of Sportsnet 590 The Fan shows are Apple Podcast subscribed. I consume 90% of my audio listening by podcast. I just do because of my schedule. I listen to three things driving in. I listen to three different things driving in. So again, Writer's Block, BLOC, and subscribe to the podcast. And you can subscribe to all the Sportsnet 590 The Fan podcasts. And of course, at the letters 31 Thoughts and Free Association as well. Buck Martinez is going to join us in a few minutes. He is the TV analyst on the international feed. The World Series Game 7 goes tonight at 8 o'clock on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. And Sportsnet, we'll talk to Buck about his view of that play last night. And, it was interesting. I mentioned that I watched the end of the game, and I watched MLB Network's commentary. And there was interesting byplay. There was Mark DeRosa, Pedro Martinez, Harold Reynolds, and Tom Verducci on. And it was interesting. Pedro was talking about, this is about carrying the bat.
Yeah.
And this is, Pedro's so good in TV. So they have Juan Soto, and Juan Soto was talking to them on the field, and he's explaining about carrying the bat and everything like that. And, you know, and he's got his hand on Pedro's shoulders, you know, and they ask him, well, you know, did you watch baseball growing up? And he goes, well, you know, I played a lot of video games, but when I played video baseball, I was always this guy here. I was always Pedro. He pats Pedro. Pedro smiles and says, you know what? If I'd been pitching, and I can't do Pedro's voice, but he said, if I'd been pitching last night and you'd done that, the next pitch is going in your head. And it was just,
Pedro was a tough dude.
Yeah, Pedro would have thrown at him, but as I said, and there's all sorts of different layers to that, and Harold Reynolds made the point, if he'd been a left-handed hitter, if Trey Turner been a left-handed hitter, it wouldn't have been an issue because of the way he approached it.
So they got
in this whole thing about breaking down whether the first 100 steps or whatever is towards first base matter more than the last. It's, like I said, one of those really, really bizarre baseball discussions that will drive non-baseball fans nuts, but that baseball fans themselves generally glom on.
I didn't see the postgame. How was Hinch?
Hinch was
all right. He was calm, normal.
Hinch looked like a guy who'd just seen really one of the best postseason pitching performances throwing at his team.
So just sort of, the thing about Hinch, he tipped his hat to Strasburg.
Oh, yeah. And the thing about Hinch is, and this is, it's so counter to what a lot of people think of the Astros front office, and that's a, you know, guys, Shai Davidi was talking about it. Hinch is a pretty good guy. And,
well,
like, he's,
him.
He, both of these managers have a lot of respect for each other. And in terms of the managerial matchup, it's pretty likable guys. That are easy to cheer for.
This isn't any big statement, Jeff. A.J. Hinch is the most likable person in the Astros front office, if you put the manager. It's not even close.
Yeah.
Universally liked, I think, by everybody.
Yeah, I think that's safe to say. Buck Martinez is a TV analyst on the international feed of the World Series. You've heard his work all series long, all postseason long on Sportsnet. He is in Houston getting ready for Game 7 tonight, as we all are. Martinez joins Richard Deitch and myself. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, 360.
Missed an episode of Lead Off? Listen to every episode and subscribe with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. You're experiencing Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
So I've got a question for a lot of you out there. How would you like to fly on board the Air Canada fan flight to see the Leafs play in Florida in January? Florida in January? Sign me up. You can tune in every weekday and listen for Air Canada's ideal sporting destinations for your chance to win two seats on Air Canada's fan flight to see the Leafs play in Florida. Your next destination... you got to be writing these down. Your next destination is Sydney. Collect at least five of the destinations and then listen for your cue to call on Friday the 8th for your chance to win. This contest is open to Ontario residents only. You can find more details, or further details, at sportsnet.ca/590. So I made the point in the last hour, Richard, that this World Series, that Game 6 in particular, and the issue surrounding the call in Game 6 in particular, is everything baseball fans like about baseball and love about baseball and embrace about baseball, and everything non-baseball fans hate about baseball, detest about baseball, and have no time for in baseball. Buck Martinez is our Blue Jays analyst on Sportsnet. He's also the World Series TV analyst on the international feed. We are, of course, picking up the international feed on Sportsnet. We'll have it tonight, Game 7 at 8 o'clock. The Nationals and the Astros. Buck Martinez joining Richard Deitch and myself on Writer's Block. Mr. Martinez, thank you so much for joining us. That was, as I mentioned in the last hour, I was at the Leafs game, saw the game when I got home, went to MLB Network and watched all the post-game stuff, the Joe Torre stuff and everything. Again, I know that's going to drive a lot of people nuts, but Buck, that game's why I like baseball and why I will always like baseball.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And you know what? It was really interesting to have the stars and all of the stories within that game come out and play itself out again. You know, Verlander continues to have problems in the first. He continues to have problems giving up home runs. Bregman is a big game player, and he hits another home run and then carries his bat all the way to first base. And 21-year-old Juan Soto sits out there in left field, watches him do it, and then when he hits a home run, he packs it to first base, saying, it was pretty cool what I saw Bregman do, so I thought I'd do it myself. It was a pretty interesting Game 6 for sure.
Buck, how did you view the call at first base in real time, and then what were your thoughts when you heard all the explanations after the fact?
I thought they got it right. He was inside the running lane. He never got inside that 3-foot, 45-foot long running lane. And, you know, it's probably one of the most flawed rules in all of baseball, because you're required to run in foul territory until you get to first base, and then you're supposed to step on the bag in fair territory. But I think the umpires got it right. Trey Turner interfered with Gurriel's opportunity to make a play on the ball. And you could say, well, it was a bad throw. Well, you know what? Because he was running outside that box, that's by definition the right call. Where they really kind of made some mistakes and left themselves open for criticism was the fact they went to the review. And I know they went to the review because of the protest, but it's a non-reviewable play. And I think what Gary Cederstrom did that really makes everybody a little bit uneasy about it was he held his hand up to indicate out, which generally means the call was upheld, but it's not a reviewable play. And I think, that's all the controversy. I spoke to Randy Marsh after the play happened. He came up to the booth, and we talked about it. He's the umpiring supervisor, and he felt they caught the call right, but they shouldn't have gone to replay.
Hmm. Buck, just one clarification. As someone who's broadcasting the series, you have the international broadcast. Obviously, Joe Buck, John Smoltz have the Fox broadcast. Do you get any kind of heads up from either baseball's office or something from the field with the umpires where you can explain to the audience, or do you have to decipher what's going on in real time just like the rest of us?
Yeah, we have to do it in real time, Richard. We don't have an opportunity, and obviously because things happen so quickly in any kind of sporting event, you've got to go on the fly with what you see and what your experience has allowed you to understand, and that's what we do. We don't have a chance to say timeout. Like in the NFL, and they have a regular referee, a retired referee, help them make decisions on the course of a game, but we don't have that. Only in between innings from time to time. We asked Randy Marsh to come up afterwards to get a clarification of it, and he met with both the Fox people and with us.
Mm, thanks, Buck.
Oh, Tony or Anthony Rendon makes it sort of academic. And Buck, after that call was made, I'm thinking to myself, my God, this is going to be Don Dinkinger all over again. And there's something about plays at first base. You know, third base is the hot corner and all that stuff, but it's amazing how much weird stuff happens at first base. It really is.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what? There's so many things going on, and we have made this point throughout this World Series because we've had two great first basemen with Zimmerman and Gurriel. And Gurriel's made a number of good plays over at first base, twice against Trey Turner. But, a baseball fan has a tendency to just discount the importance of a good first baseman, but we've seen it play out in this series. And, there's a lot of things that go on there. Runners coming there, balls getting there, first baseman's trying to get back to the bag, especially now with all the dramatic shifts, and oftentimes the first baseman's a long way from the bag.
Hmm. Buck, great. There was a great story by Tom Verducci on Sports Illustrated's website today about Steven Strasburg and the national staff recognizing and realizing he was tipping pitches and the adjustment they made after the first inning. I wonder, again, from being a former catcher and from all your broadcasting experience, did you, while watching the game yesterday, did you notice anything dramatically different in Strasburg from that first inning then to the second and third inning?
He has had a history of doing this, and that's why he is pitching out of the stretch. He minimized a lot of the different stops in his glove and his hands and the way he was manipulating the baseball as he tried to grip the various pitches that he throws. But to be honest with you, no. And at that point, you're so focused on pitch sequences and everything else. It takes a handful of guys, and I'm sure, given the controversy we have seen with the Astros, that everybody was focused from that Nationals dugout just watching their own pitcher. Mm-hmm. And, some of the pitchers that aren't active, and Wade Miley is one of them, and I talked to Garrett Cole about this. Miley has been watching the games from inside to help his pitchers, basically on pitch selection and setting up and sequencing. And he sat in the clubhouse for games one and two. They lost both games. So in three, four, and five, he sat in the dugout. He didn't want to watch on TV anymore, and I don't think he was inside yesterday. But for me, I can honestly say, there's so many things going on. That's kind of the last thing I worry about. But when you start to see as many good swings as they had, you start to think maybe they have something. And you know what? They rectified it quickly, certainly. And, Strasburg was really good pitching into the ninth inning.
Buck, you know what? It almost makes me wonder how much that goes on and we don't hear about it. You know, there's a lot of media coverage of the World Series. You've got reporters on both dugouts. I know we have reporters in dugouts as well, but there's so much focus and so much emphasis on it. It makes me wonder how often that happens in a game and we just don't know about it.
I don't think it happens as much as we think.
Really? Okay.
To be honest with you.
Yeah. Okay.
I just don't think it. I think the Astros are using a little gamesmanship as well when they're all covering their mouth and they're whispering to one another, and it makes everybody think, oh, they got something. And then the pitcher's going to hesitate, and he's wondering, you know, what am I doing? What am I doing? So there's some doubts in his mind. So I think there's more gamesmanship involved. And we have seen catchers, Maldonado and Chirinos and Yan Gomes, have all been crossed up in this series. Because they're using so many different sets of signs, they will literally change the sequence of signs they're using in at-bats. Not just in between innings, but in at-bats they're switching. And you have seen several pitches where the catchers have been crossed up. I don't know if they're crossing themselves up or the pitchers crossing them up, but there have been cross-ups.
Buck, now that you've seen a steady diet of Juan Soto, and of course you saw Ronald Acuna earlier, I don't want to draw a comparison between Soto and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. because different players, different body types, et cetera, et cetera. But when I look at Juan Soto, I'm beginning to wonder if the bar for young players isn't even higher than I thought it was originally. Because this guy's not much older than Vladdy.
No, I agree with you 100%. He is so savvy and so aware. During the workout game prior to game one, and Kevin Long was telling me that he has a higher ceiling than anybody he's worked with.
Wow.
And that includes Derek Jeter and Robinson Cano. Hmm. So, you know, he's a very special guy. He's very, very aware. He's very animated, obviously. And all of that routine with his kicking at the dirt and wandering up and down in batter's box, that's all by design. He said, I am in control of that batter's box. That's my batter's box. And if I get the pitcher to be a little bit distracted, if he buys into my antics a little bit, then I have won. He's really aware and really understands. And if you think back to game one, he hit the home run up onto the railroad tracks. He had a line drive off the score. But he got three hits in his first World Series game. You know what? We have seen it with Bregman. We have seen it with Correa. We've seen it with Altuve. The best players in the game think they're the best players on the field. And you don't have a problem with that. I don't, certainly, because they can get it done. And when he hit that home run, you know, there was a little bit of misunderstanding in the Verlander banter because some people thought he was getting on Soto, but he was actually getting on the home plate umpire. He thought he'd made a good pitch, and he's hollered out, not here, not now. Don't miss that call, because he's trying to set up a great hitter. And then that banter, and he got distracted in the next pitch that Soto hits into the second deck in right field, but a tremendous matchup. And I agree with you. I think Juan Soto is among the best young players we've seen come into the game for a long time, and I'll put him in that Ken Griffey category right now.
Buck, we're about 5 hours away from opening pitch, which you can catch on Sportsnet. And what is your sense regarding tonight? What do you expect will happen?
I think, Richard, it's really interesting because we have the 7th and 8th Cy Young Award winners matching up in a Game 7 in the World Series. Sandy Koufax won in 65. Chris Carpenter, the former Blue Jay, won in 2011 as former Cy Young Award winners. And the losers include Mike Cuellar. He lost in 71. Mm. And the other pitchers to pitch but didn't get a decision, Bob Turley in 60, Roger Clemens in 2001, and Corey Kluber in 2016. So you asked for a marquee matchup. We got it. And, you know, everybody was overlooking Zach Greinke, but he pitched a heck of a game in Game 3 to get the Astros back in it, even though he only pitched into the fourth inning, did not complete the fifth. So I think we're in for it. I think the big question mark is, yeah, everybody says Max Scherzer is good to go tonight, but how good is he going to be? Sunday, he couldn't move his neck.
Mm-hmm.
And they shot him up with cortisone. They put a neck brace on him on the plane down here to Houston. And I watched him throw yesterday before the game, and he looked free and easy. And then you saw him pacing in the bullpen last night. He thought he was going to come into that game until Rendon hit the home run. But I just don't know how much you're going to get from Max Scherzer. I know you're going to get everything he has, but what is that going to be?
Buck, do you think if this game demands it tonight that we might see Strasburg in this game?
No.
Okay.
I don't think you'll see Strasburg. I think you might see Garrett Cole.
Okay.
I think you'll see Strasburg. I think he emptied the tank last night. He pitched out of so many situations. I thought the game was decided, and I said it on the air when it happened in the fifth inning when he's got runners at second and third and one out. To get Altuve to strike out on three pitches and then get Michael Brantley hitting ground ball out to get out of it, I thought that was the ball game. And I think, you know, everybody talks about emotions and pitch counts and how tired are you. I think that's when Strasburg showed who he was. And he was able to get out two of the toughest hitters in those situations. He got Altuve on three pitches, and he was overmatched. And then Michael Brantley, as he's done so often in this postseason, hits the ball hard, but hits it into the shift and grounds out to end the inning. I thought that was the ball game right there in that fifth inning.
I know, Buck, I know Jeff Blair doesn't believe in momentum in baseball. I'm not sure how you feel about that. But is there any carryover from what happened last night to tonight?
I think there is carryover because of the emotions. You know, there haven't been any game changing scores. We had one lead change in the first game, and that was it until last night. And all of a sudden, now we've got the Bregman home run, we've got the Soto home run, we've got an ejection from Dave Martinez. AJ Hinch came out and argued that they made the wrong call, and there were a lot of things going on. And I think this is going to be a very emotional game tonight. I think both of these teams are primed and ready. And yeah, I think we should see a special game tonight. And if you're asking me who's going to win, I have no idea.
Hey, Buck, we appreciate you joining us. Thanks so much. Really enjoyed your work. Looking forward to tonight and safe travels once it's all said and done, my friend. Thank you for your help.
All right. Thanks a lot. Great to be with you guys. Should be fun tonight.
Take care. Buck Martinez, our World Series TV analyst and Sportsnet. A reminder that Justin Morneau, World Series analyst and Sportsnet, will join us at 4:25 as well. Be interesting. Get Justin's take as a former first baseman. I'm sure he's been in that play. And one point Buck stressed, and that I think people need to keep in mind, he used the phrase, made it impossible for him to make a play on the ball. That is not the same thing as catching the ball and making an out. And by the letter of the law, making the play on the ball means being able to catch the ball. Doesn't matter if the runner's past the bag. Doesn't matter if the runner's fall down. It's interfering with the first baseman's ability to make the play. And again, I'm going to give Gary Seeder some credit for this. And Verducci pointed this out as well. If you watch the replay, the positioning of the home plate umpire was perfect to make the call. And they're just showing it right now. And I'm just looking at TV. I mean, you cannot be better positioned if you're the home plate umpire. You cannot be better positioned if you're the home plate umpire to make that play. So, again, the proper call with a really bad rule. And again, it'll be interesting to see whether or not that comes up for discussion when general managers meet. I think it's a week, 10 days after the end of the World Series.
You know what's interesting, Jeff, because I think we all feel this, including Buck, is that no one has any feel for tonight. Like, at one point, I think you would have been like, you know, I was sure the Astros were winning yesterday. I had a great feeling. I was obviously wrong. But, like, tonight, literally, I have no idea who's going to win.
No, Game 7's, you know, the most memorable Game 7 I covered was 2001 when Arizona beat the Yankees.
And, Luis Gonzalez?
Yeah, Luis Gonzalez. And that was a hard series to call because Arizona just hit the living hell out of the Yankees. In that series. I had no feel as well until Mariano Rivera came into the game with the lead. And I remember we'd all written our stories and
right.
I'd filed mine because Mariano Rivera never, I remember the lead. It was Alfonso Soriano had a great game. It was kind of the passing of the torch. You know, it was going to be the end of the Jeter sort of dynasty, Yankees, Cano, Soriano, blah, 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 blah. Most of us had our stories in. Then Luis Gonzalez singles in, drives a run in. The Diamondbacks win. Nobody saw it coming because, again, Mariano never, ever, 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 ever blows games. And I don't know who it was, but we were like a couple of hours later, we're having beers, and somebody said, you know what we should do? We should all collect the game stories we wrote and sent in with the Yankees winning.
Love that.
And do a book. just on this is like the anti-history or the revisionist history.
Now on the web, you can do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Which would be so fun to read. I think I'm right about this. Alfonso Soriano would have been the MVP of the World Series, right?
I think he would have,
Yankees won. Which, again, you think differently of his career if that happened.
I think you are accurate.
He had a
terrific World Series, and that was just that whole World Series was
well, it was in the shadow of 9/11.
And you know, the only moment I really sort of felt an affinity for George Bush, other than when he bought a bunch of us beers at the winter meetings one time when he was Texas Rangers owner, was when he strolled out to the mound to throw that first pitch. That was pretty
incredible.
That was pretty
amazing.
Pretty amazing.
I will say that, again, I'm not making any money off this, but there's an amazing book by a guy named Garrett Graff called The Only Plane in the Sky, and it's an oral history of 9/11, including hundreds of pages on what was going on Air Force One with George W. Bush and his group. Reading that book, you do have more of an affinity for Bush when you read about what was going on with him in that time. My caveat is I probably feel that way because of what is going on with this current president.
You have
much more respect for Bush in hindsight, given what's going on now. But that was Jeff living in New York City at that time. That series was incredible. The emotion that people had for baseball
in
New York in 2011 in 2001, was unbelievable.
Hell, I'm old enough that this current guy has me pining for Richard Nixon every now and then.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but I can't disagree.
Rob Stone is host of the MLS on Fox. Your Toronto FC are in Atlanta to play Atlanta United tonight. A win and Toronto FC goes to the MLS Cup against who else? The Seattle Sounders. Rob Stone joins us next. It's Writer's Block on 590 and 360.
Missed an episode of Hockey Central? Listen to every episode and subscribe with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590, The Fan on Demand. Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, so Brandeo, we've got to do our guilty pleasure list. We'll do it next week. We'll give everybody a heads up. We put together music for the radio side. We've got Jen Rolnick, Travis McKenzie, Derek Brandeo, Deitch, and myself. Got to put together a list, each of us. Pick a day, we'll put together a list of our guilty pleasures for music, and that'll be the soundtrack.
It's gonna be get ready for a lot of Joy Division from me, though.
I thought you were a Living Color guy.
I don't want to read.
I know. I want to go.
A good debate.
I don't want to go back there. Joy Division. Oh,
Living Color is underrated.
Joy Division. But let's lighten the mood. Let's let's play some Joy Division. Anyhow,
that's funny.
So, and you know what? And you understand the whole guilty pleasure thing. Like, you know, like guilty pleasures are music that you shouldn't admit to listening to. Like, Kickstart My Heart is going to be number one.
Joy Division would not be mine.
I would never.
I have no problem admitting that, but I'll think of some stuff.
Joy Division, but stuff like Motley Crue. No 59-year-old man is good to admit that he likes
Motley Crue. I have to say, I think Fleetwood Mac for me may be a bit of a guilty pleasure. Some Fleetwood Mac songs.
All right. Fleetwood Mac. Derek Brandeo says 59-year-old men listening to One Direction would be an example. I will have a One Direction song on my guilty pleasure list.
Really?
I took my daughter to two One Direction concerts.
Wow.
Father of the Year. And I always tell the story that when the lights are out at a One Direction concert, you can tell the adults, because if you look in the crowd, all the heads jumping up and down are kids. All the heads sitting down are the parents. That's how you know you're at a One Direction concert. Parents just kind of hiding and saying, what do I get into? So anyhow, yes, I'll have a little One Direction, little Motley Crue.
Motley Crue is a garbage band. You know, I realize how popular they were, but in hindsight.
They're not garbage. They're
Tommy
great
Lee,
party
Nikki
music.
Six. Ah,
they're great
there's
party
so many
music.
Better metal bands than those clowns.
They're not metal.
How would you define
their hair. They're a hair band.
Like, I actually think Rat is an underrated band for that era.
God, look at Travis is just burying his head in his hands.
Poison is another garbage band.
Okay. Anyhow, a reminder, by the way, before we get to Rob Stone, who's holding on going, why the hell did I agree to do this?
What a segue he's
indeed. Your team could be playing in a game called by Joe Bowen and Jim Ralph live at Sportsnet 590. The Fan is the first annual Champions of Rec League Cup at the Mattamy Athletic Center. If your team was nominated, tune in every weekday to hear if we announce your name. This is not well written. If you haven't entered yet, you can still enter online for a chance to be the wildcard team. Andrew Commission from Barry nominated and captains the team Pine Cones. I've been very disappointed in the quality of some of these teams' names, by the way.
Yeah.
Manchester United remains the best. But anyhow, Andrew Commission from Barry nominated and captains the team Pine Cones. If you're in the team Pine Cones, you have 590 seconds to call us at 416-870-0590, star 591, 888-666-0590. To qualify for the voting round of this contest, full contest details are available at sportsnet.ca/590. Toronto FC is in Atlanta to play Atlanta United tonight. Hence, we are bringing on Rob Stone. He's host of the MLS and Fox, in addition to NCAA football, PBA, and myriad other sports. Former WWE 24/7 champion.
Wow, you got that plug in there. Nice.
How you doing, Mr. Stone?
Jeff, and for Travis, I'm here to kickstart your heart. Richard, you're way off target here. I'd love me a little Joy Division here and there, but Motley Crue, I mean, top-level hair metal.
Rob, you're a California guy. Of course
come on,
you're
Motley.
Jump on Motley
Crue. I'm serious. Kickstart my heart would be firing in my Walkman headset when I was getting ready for
absolutely
basketball or soccer game.
Rob,
absolutely. Yeah. Driving, you know what?
I will also, hold on, wait, I'm sorry, because I have to sit on hold to listen to you guys talk about your music, Guilty Pleasures. Another one, Richard, your good friend, Alexi Lawless and I, we have similar musical veins, and we have been spotted driving down the 405 late at night, windows down, with Def Leppard Foolin' at 11.
So, oh, Def Leppard, yeah. Saw.
I will say this, Rob, and you can appreciate this, and Jeff, you obviously are very familiar with the with Alexi Lawless's soccer career and now broadcasting. I mean, I like to call him
recording career now.
Yeah, the Diego Maradona of Fox Sports. That's a lot.
Jeez, I wouldn't go that far.
I will say this.
Minus the drug issues.
Yeah,
exactly.
Allegedly. All right, so the thing about Alexi, though, in his sort of soccer prime, that guy literally has a look that is perfect for, like, an album cover. Like, Alexi Lawless, would you agree, Rob? Like, when Alexi in his prime wanted to, he literally does look like a glam rocker.
Absolutely. And he doesn't need the wig, right? He didn't need any props. He was, that's who he was. When he was, when he took his quote unquote break from the game, you know, he toured. You know, he and his band went on the road, and we were actually working at that point while he was on his sabbatical, and we played a gig together in Columbus, Ohio, at some outdoor, I don't know what the hell it was, but I know at some point I was on stage with him singing to a heavy metal type song. So yes, he and I go way, way too far back.
Yeah, Lyles is, he's an interesting, his opinion on sports studio shows is horrible, but he really is an interesting, it's terrible. He really is an interesting guy. He's had an interesting life and an interesting career, and he's an interesting thinker. I have to give him that. Anyway. Sorry,
yeah. And I'll tell you what, also just a really good human being, a really
that's
caring,
good to hear.
Intelligent guy, regardless of what the folks on Twitter may say about it.
He takes some shots.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, you know, if the folks on Twitter don't like you, to me, that's, you've got one foot in heaven. So, I mean, that's the way I look at it. I think there's kind of an inverse thing happening there.
One foot in heaven.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's slightly extreme, but I kind of dig that, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, you know, every now and then I pull something out of my ass and it makes sense.
Well, good.
Toronto
soccer.
FC.
You want to talk soccer?
Yes. Toronto FC and Atlanta United. Not an easy match, obviously, for Toronto FC. What do you think will be the key to sort of breaking down Atlanta United? I mean, scoring a goal would seem to be paramount, to say the least, and it's not always easy to do against Atlanta.
No, it's not. And, everything has been kind of different this year in MLS playoffs. Look, I'm an MLS kind of purist type guy. I've been with them essentially since the second year. I've always felt that this MLS playoff property is that one great lost sports broadcasting entity, particularly in America. It just gets drowned out with the start of NBA and the baseball playoffs going on and college football and NFL, that the best time of the year is just lost on the American soccer world, and it's a shame. But MLS has tweaked the playoff format this year where every series is a one-off. It's not a two-game series, home and away. It's one game, winner take all. And I think that has really kind of sparked a lot of these teams, and they know that they don't have that 90 minutes to kind of you know, bob and weave and get a couple body blows in instead. It's like, we got to find that knockout punch. We got to somehow survive. And it's ignited these playoffs. The scoring is way up. The drama is intense. You see what happened last night with the best team in the league through the course of MLS's history. LAFC upset at home by Seattle, and not just by one goal, but by two goals. And this is after LAFC took an early 1-0 lead, and then they surrender three unanswered goals. So my point is, I think it's really hard to predict these things. Look, Toronto already knocked off last week the number one seed in the East in New York City. So what's to say that they can't do it tonight in Atlanta? But this Atlanta team is loaded, and they've got so many game breakers. And to me, playoffs, no matter the sport, you know, if it's a college football playoffs, I look at the four teams that have those difference makers, have the players that can say, when everything is level, this is what's going to elevate us over you. And for me right now, that's what Atlanta has. They just have too many game breakers compared to what Toronto has. You know, Pozzuolo and Bradley are kind of the nuts and bolts, the guts of this team. Can those two guys kind of carry the other nine and whoever they need off the bench to get past this Atlanta team? But I know it sounds heavily tilted towards Atlanta with my conversation right now, but I just love the fact that Toronto's kind of stealth. Here they are in the Final Four, you know, one win away from getting into their third MLS Cup in 4 years. They're in the midst of a 12-game unbeaten run. They have a 7-game road unbeaten streak. They've never lost a road playoff game in the United States. They've got all these weird kind of momentum numbers that really kind of make you hit that pause button and say, wait a second. You know, so I see this one as kind of a tighter one-goal affair, and frankly, extra time wouldn't surprise me at all.
Rob, I want to, understanding that you work for the rights holder and you've been involved in this league for a long time, so you have a vested interest in it. But where do you see, or do you see, growth still happening for MLS in terms of whatever metrics you want to use? Television viewership, in-game stadium attendance. It's certainly a mature league, and for those who love the league, they love it. But you do wonder, is there another wave, I guess, of fandom still left for this league?
I think absolutely. It's a totally fair question, because as many pluses as you want to find, as you want to spin, Richard, there's definitely still those negative perceptions and numbers that exist with MLS. And a lot of it, fairly or unfairly, and I think unfairly, is that it gets compared to the EPL and the head start that England and Europe have over what Major League Soccer has done. When you compare those two entities, MLS is still an infant. You know, it's still holding mom and dad's hand, trying to walk around the living room without cracking their head, you know, on the kitchen room table or something. So I think the ceiling is still out there. I don't think we've even seen the ceiling through the gaze of the MLS eyes. The growth continues into other markets. You see the in-game attendance numbers really continue to rise. You see this growth of kind of the second wave of MLS. Seattle really kick-started a couple years ago. Toronto continued it. What Portland and Atlanta have been able to do as well. And I see this as a real growth industry. But the big bugaboo number is these television numbers, Richard. Yep. Nobody can figure out how to make it work, how to get more eyeballs on these games. And Fox, to their credit, has done some really interesting programming type nuances that have added numbers. They might have also skewed them too, Richard, to be honest with you, where they'll pair an MLS game, whether it's regular season or playoffs, right in the midst of one of those odd NFL doubleheaders where, hey, you only get one game in your area, but right after that NFL game, boom, here's MLS. Frankly, PBA Bowling has done that as well, and they're going to do it this Sunday in the United States as well. And we got huge numbers for bowling. We got huge numbers for soccer. You know, it's one of those commas. Big numbers, comma, for soccer. So I think it's still a growth industry, and I really, truly believe that. But there are some issues that they've got to get over. They've got to get television eyeballs. They've got to continue to increase the level of play on the field. And they've done a really remarkable job in that facet over the last 3-4 years. Toronto has probably, frankly, been the poster child of kickstarting that success on the field by being ambitious and going out and spending money and getting players that have quality and also name recognition and guys who aren't here to retire. And a lot of clubs in Atlanta has kind of taken that mantle and run with it and finding these young South American type players who they may or may not be able to afford right now, but they know damn well in a year or two, we could never have a shot with them. So they kind of stretch the budget, kind of like when you look for your first house, like, this is my budget. but I really want that house. That's another, you know, $40,000-$50,000. Let's spend now and hopefully recoup it on the back end. So I do see this league growing in the right direction, but still, as with any league, as you guys know, there's some nuances that need to be fixed.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of things, you know, that come to mind immediately about MLS. The first is, I think it's, you know, with the continued growth of legalized gambling, you're going to see additional revenue streams for every sport in North America. But the other thing, Rob, and you know, I'd be interested in your view in this, specifically because, you know, you do work for Fox. I think at some point we are going to see some sort of formal merger between League MX and Major League Soccer. And to me, that's the key. To me, that's where your growth is.
Yeah.
I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, here's how I feel about it. I think MLS needs Liga MX more than Liga MX needs MLS. I think if you're Liga MX, for the most part, you're saying to yourself, well, why do we need to bother with this mess? Like, we've got it pretty good. We're actually pulling in some, you know, non-Mexican international flavor talent right now. We've become a slight destination to be at. In the end, I think you're right, where MLS is saying, wait, if we can somehow crack into Mexico City and company and kind of spread our arm around that country, this is a way where we can really grow as a family, as a North American family, and then obviously pull, you know, the Canadian clubs into that as well. I don't think it's just, obviously, it's not just a U.S.-Mexico merger. It's a Canada-U.S., i.e. MLS, mm-hmm. merger with Mexico. That's a long ways down the road. But you're right, because they've clearly dipped their toes, MLS and League MX, into this collaboration, if you will. You know, they've staged games. They've staged kind of these odd tournaments that are trying to declare, you know, the champion. There is the CONCACAF Champions League, which says, you know, you are the best team in the CONCACAF region. And, you know, Costa Rica and Panama are involved in that as well and having success. But I don't see that as a play in the near future, and I'm talking like a decade.
Mm-hmm.
Even beyond that, I think it's just so tricky. I think the league continues to grow here in the U.S. and Canada at a rate where it's pretty much maxed out. Maybe another couple cities could come under the MLS umbrella, but then if you're going to throw that umbrella inside the same umbrella stand with what Liga MX has, boom, you're looking at scheduling travel nightmares. And don't even get the politics involved in this one, right? With the travel between countries and who's in charge and who's not in charge and how that all works out. But it is an interesting thought. I think I would see it as a more likely scenario, almost if you were in Europe and you were saying, hey, Austria and Switzerland, why don't we join forces?
Mm.
Something that's a little bit more manageable geographically, size-wise, travel-wise. But in the end, it's a curious thought, and it's clear if you look at MLS's actions over the last couple of years, they do want to foster some type of relationship with Liga MX.
Rob, it's great to join us. Thanks so much. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Rob.
You got it, guys. Have a great week.
You too. Rob Stone.
Rob Stone of
Fox Sports.
MLS.
Yeah, the
Fox. And I'm picturing Alexi. I'm picturing him driving down the 405.
Rocking out the Def Leppard.
Yeah.
The I will say,
convertible.
Jeff, oh, for sure.
Motley Crue.
Rob Stone.
In-N-Out Burger.
Rob Stone.
The holy trinity of California road tripping.
Stone and Lawless are very California guys. The which is not a knock, but they just are.
No.
The thing, Jeff, if they ever did merge with Liga MX, you would think of that league like globally different.
Yep.
Like at the end of the day, it's never going to be the Premier League and then La Liga or Serie A, however you determine your next like sort of three or four best leagues. But if they merged, I feel like they're at least in the conversation with, you know, number four or number five best leagues in the world. I don't know how you put the Bundesliga versus Serie A. I always think of La Liga as the second best league in the world behind the Premier League. But maybe that's debatable too.
I mean, I would go La Liga, Serie A.
1A, 1B, says Derek. Yeah, I'd buy that.
Bundesliga. I'd put the Bundesliga maybe a little bit above Liga.
So the question would be, what's the fifth best soccer league in the world right now? Like, what do they call France? League One?
Probably, you know what's probably the fifth best league is? It's probably the championship in England. The English second division.
Think about that. Maybe.
That's better than MLS.
Derek says French league. PSG is in the French league, so you got a big time team.
I don't
there.
Know. Portugal, there's like three teams.
Yeah. But my point is, if they merged,
Yeah.
If they merge, though, then at least they're in the conversation of that, like, bottom five, right?
Yeah.
I think the
biggest thing is, you know, the biggest thing is, and Rob did hit the nail on the head. There's more in it for MLS.
Oh, for sure.
Than there is for League MX. The only way that changes is if you can somehow convince League MX that there's areas of growth in cities with large Latino populations.
Right.
Like Chicago, like New York, you know, and as I always in Miami, but as I always have people tell me whenever I make that point, they say, don't lump all Latino sports fans together because,
right.
You know, not every Latino person is going to be a Mexican soccer fan.
Correct. Yeah. A lot. In fact, I would think that the majority of Latinos in the U.S. are probably, they would pick U.S. as their first team and yeah. Maybe Mexico second. Maybe,
yeah, or
someone else.
Or Brazil or Argentina.
Whatever. Right.
But the point is that I think there has to be some sort of expansion of the regional footprint
for MLS. But Rob is right about travel is a big one to figure out. And then secondly, if the politics do not work in terms of the leadership, that's a mess.
Yeah. We'll take a break. Deitch and myself will be back. It's Writer's Block on 590 and 360.
Subscribe to the Good Show podcast with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, we have a few minutes before CJ, Chris Johnson, joins us. Derek Brandeo playing Foolin' for Deitch.
For the radio audience. It's good. I mean, if you hear...
You can't have depressing music as a guilty pleasure.
But again, for anyone who's heard that, if they're listening in their car elsewhere, is that uplifting?
Yes!
I don't know. I'm starting to think Def Leppard, any song
you can sing really loud with a beer in your hand is good. You can't sing a Joy Division song loud.
No, listen, Joy Division is not a party song. I like that era of like...
You like Bleak.
Yeah, I like the Bleak punk, electronic. Like the Bleak punk era from England.
That's not
post-punk. Post-punk, sorry.
So you like sort of Echo and the Bunny Man.
I love Echo and the Bunny Man.
Yeah. Okay, I don't mind Echo and the Bunny Man either.
But I can't pick that as my guilty pleasure
list. No, because it's...
Like, people love Echo and the Bunny Man, yeah.
Well, it's not... Again, it's
I see a little silhouette of a man.
What was that?
Sounded like you. What do you think of the Go-Go's?
Oh, that's when I was... that's when I was trying to get Siri. Because there's a thing in Siri where if you ask it, if you just say, I see a little silhouette of a man, right. It'll respond.
Really?
Yeah.
Scary. Do you Go-Go's, like them or not?
Yeah, that's a guilty pleasure. That's pure guilty pleasure.
All right, good.
We got The Beat is tremendous.
Underrated.
Our Lips Are Sealed. No, they're not underrated.
They absolutely are. They're pioneering band, Jeff. All women.
Think of what they did in the music industry,
male-dominated music industry.
No.
Come on, Jeff.
The Slits are more important than they are to women's place in music. Go-Go's weren't underrated. But they were fine. They are a guilty pleasure. Our Lips Are Sealed. It qualifies as a guilty pleasure.
I think there's better Go-Go songs, I think.
No. Well, maybe. But that would be on a list. But you see what I'm getting at when I say guilty pleasure. It's got to be sort of stuff that you feel, well, stuff you feel guilty singing.
Yeah, I understand. There are,
like any Bon Jovi song. Any Bon Jovi song.
Oof. Bon Jovi, though, is a good one. Because they have had so many hits. And I kind of think they're garbage, too. But maybe that's me just sort of, because, again, I grew up in New York. They're a big Jersey, big hair band. I might have my own bias.
I mean, but you can't say they're
garbage. They're Hall of Famers.
Well, that doesn't matter. I mean, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is like,
right.
You know.
I'm not trying to play, I'm not trying to wave the home flag here, but I love Rush. I think they're underrated, actually, historically.
You are waving the home flag.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, you are. I'm not going to go on a soliloquy about Nickelback.
Next thing, I'm not going to say Nickelback.
Next thing you're going to be going on Twitter and you're going to be sucking up to all the Rush fans out there. Could you do that? You don't have to do that. We're comfortable in our own skin. We don't need you to suck up to us to like you.
I get it. I'm the one who's always, I've told every Canadian broadcaster I know who goes to the States, who has this inferiority complex, like, oh, I gotta work at ESPN to make it. It's total BS. Nonsense.
Anyhow.
Now I gotta think of my band for guilty pleasure. And Bon Jovi is garbage. I stand
by that.
Bon
Jovi is not garbage. Yeah. They're not great. I mean, it's not high art, but you can't. They're a good pop band.
I think Jen Rolnick just got mad at me for dropping some Bon Jovi.
Bon Jovi is a good pop band. You've got to be comfortable, Richard, with embracing pop music.
I could think of 50 bands I'd rather have playing than Bon Jovi right now, including Squeeze.
Squeeze is fine. But you're missing the whole point, as usual. Chris Johnson's next. It's Writer's Block.
Subscribe to the Leafs Hour podcast with your favorite podcatcher, Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Once a sports reporter, always a sports reporter. Sometimes a cynical and sarcastic sports reporter, but yeah, always a sports reporter. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, enough talk about guilty pleasures. Let's talk about guilty head coaches. Just kidding. I swear to God, I was at the game last night. I had my ears open for Fire Babcock chants.
I don't think you heard any. I didn't hear any.
Yeah. Just heard some booing. But I don't want to get in that bandwagon necessarily. A reminder that Game 7 of the World Series goes tonight at 8 o'clock on Sportsnet 590. The Fan and Sportsnet. Justin Morneau will be part of our hour-long pre-game show, which means it'll start at 7. And Justin Morneau joins us at 4:25. And as I mentioned, Justin Morneau, a former first baseman, so we'll look forward to having him break down that play at first base and talk about maybe what's going through the minds of the Houston Astros and the Washington Nationals right now. We're little more than four hours away from first pitch in Houston. And see what type of drama Game 7 gives us. There will be hockey on Sportsnet 1, Wednesday night hockey. The Oilers and Jackets at 7:30. Canucks and Kings at 10:30. Both of those games on Sportsnet 1. Chris Johnson is our senior hockey writer and insider with Sportsnet, and he joins Richard Deitch and myself in the Writer's Block. Hello, CJ.
What's going on, Jeff?
So I was at the game last night.
On purpose?
Yeah. I got a new schedule. I can get out and I can actually hopefully watch some of the stuff that I pontificate on.
That's a novel concept.
It certainly is in this industry. Tell me about it. But anyhow, you got to answer a question for me, though. And, mm-hmm. and this is you're going to get this when I go to these games. I'm going to apologize in advance. But we'll talk about all the bigger issues later on. You've got a 5-on-3, call a timeout. Is the play you come up with really Tyson Barrie firing the puck from the point?
Well, you know, I think there's a couple things here. That was their first 5-on-3 of the season. So, you know, it's obviously something they've worked on in practice.
Okay.
But haven't really had much game use. And, you know, I don't know that the play is to have him shooting from the point. But clearly they have him in that situation to move the puck around. And you know, the timeout was called at that point in time because the other guys had been on the ice for quite a while. So, I'm sure he wanted to get Riley and Matthews and Marner and company a little bit of a breather before going into that 5-on-3.
But, that's fair.
You know, I doubt that play is called, you know, specifically to get Tyson Barrie a shot. I think that it's really about trying to move the puck around and get anyone open for a look. And, you know, let's face it, at that point in the game, that was earlier on the Leafs power play wasn't doing too much. I think it actually came on later. Mm-hmm. They did get one power play goal from Austin Matthews in the third period. But you know, the power play is among the issues that the team is kind of navigating right now. They've only got two goals, I believe, in six or seven games on the power play, which, you know, some of that is because they haven't got a lot of opportunities, but also, you know, they're not clicking at their absolute most efficiency. And we'll see what happens if they get another 5-on-3 at some point here.
Chris, last night, 1 of 8 on the power play and a massive amount of time in terms of being man advantage. Understanding that John Tavares is not in the lineup at the moment, from your perspective, why are they struggling?
Well, they, for some reason, they haven't done a very good job of entering the zone. And you know, I think that the struggles almost start from their inability to get set up and really get the puck working around. You know, as I mentioned to Jeff's question, I think they, you know, they made a couple tweaks, moved Matthews back to the left side from being on the right side of the ice. And you know, I think in the last couple power plays, they did create a little bit more havoc and have better movement there. But, you know, it's a bit perplexing. You know, I think some of this can be chalked up to just getting used to new systems. There's a new assistant coach, Paul McFarlane, in charge of the power play. But, you know, it's such a bonus if you have a team the way the Leafs are built with elite offensive stars. But I feel like the frustration level goes a little higher when those guys don't produce, just because, you know, each of them just expect to be able to be put out there and to score. And you know, they haven't been bad early in the season, but they certainly haven't been as dominant as they probably should be. And you know, especially in a game like that where really if you break down, I mean, it was a strange game with so many penalties on both sides last night. But the main reason I think if you step back and look at it, the Leafs lost that game is that, you know, they only did convert one of those 8 opportunities and they allowed 2 power play goals against. I mean, it was a special teams result at the end of the night. You know, at 5-on-5, I thought the Leafs more than held their own against the Capitals. So, you know, it's a big area of focus, I think, for the team. And you know, it really starts with just getting in the zone and moving it around and making the penalty killers uncomfortable. Because as we saw with the Capitals power play, I mean, they those guys really were snapping it around, set up Ovechkin for, I think he had 13 of his 16 shot attempts with the man advantage. I mean, John Carlson has a bomb. You want to get the penalty killers a bit uncomfortable. And I don't think the Leafs have done that enough in the last little stretch here.
Chris, you know, one of the things, the issues of the game last night too, the number of penalties called, there were some bizarre penalties you don't often see called. And I'm not, you know, that, I mean, they were penalties. I'm not saying that, but it just seemed as if that was difficult for anybody to get any flow in that game. Right. I mean, what were the shots 10 minutes into the, or halfway through the game? I think the Leafs may have had 9 shots. I don't know. Washington may have had 16, 15. It was an odd game to really, at least in the first half, to really read a whole lot into, wasn't it? Because it did seem as if it was hard. There was hard for either team to really get any sort of rhythm going, because you're either a man short or it's 4-on-4. You know, it seemed as if there was hard to get any flow there.
Yeah, well, definitely the rhythm's disrupted on both benches when you have that much time on specialty teams. I mean, the reality of that is each team probably has, what, 8-10 players that really aren't getting on the ice at all, just because,
right,
you know, the third and fourth lines don't, you know, a couple guys are killing penalties in those situations. But in general, you're not using your entire bench too much when you get in a night like that. And, you know, I think it was kind of strange officiating. I mean, the Leafs getting 8 power plays, it was on 8 minors. You know, it just, you know, there was a physical game, mm-hmm. certainly by today's standards and by, you know, the standards of two teams that score a lot, but aren't necessarily known for pugilism of any sort. But, you know, I think it did disrupt everything that was going on. It's a little tougher to get a read on things other than the specialty teams on a night like that. And you know, I do think it compounded, especially early, to some of Toronto's frustrations, just because, you know, it's been a bit of a rough go here. And the fact that the power play didn't produce early on, I mean, they had, you know, the first couple chances in the first period. I mean, they could have grabbed an early lead that, you know, might have changed the complexion of the game and weren't able to do so. You know, that being said, they fought through it and tied it up and then take 2 penalties in overtime. I mean, just a weird night, you know, lack of crispness. And, you know, I think the referees were calling a pretty strict standard and you know, you won't see many games. Put it this way, if you watch the next 68 games or whatever the Leafs have left in the regular season, you probably won't see them get 8 power plays again this year.
No, you made you asked Mike Babcock an interesting question in the post game media session. I think it was your question about Austin Matthews and on the tying goal. It kind of did a bit of a flyby. I think that was your question. I'm going to apologize if it wasn't. But
No, that was Ken Campbell from the Hockey News.
Close. Okay. Well, I'm sorry. I'm sure you've been mistaken for worse. But anyhow, that particular play, coupled with the penalties that were taken, the penalty from William Nylander, and then of course Mitch Marner. How frustrating would that be for Mike Babcock? Those kind of I'm reaching in with my stick to do something penalties, because those plays in particular seem to get under his skin, don't they?
They do. You know, I think the biggest frustration in a game like that is just not finding a way to win. I mean, we don't even have to stretch imagination to come up with a way that the Leafs get 2 points out of that game. They're up 3-2 in the third period. Mm. They if they don't take those penalties in overtime and just let overtime play out as it will, you know, I think the Leafs would take their skill against the Cap skill in that scenario and like their chances of finding a way to get another goal. And so, you know, I think really the craziest part when you look at the Leafs' start here is that 6 of the 8 games they've lost, they either led or were tied in the third period. That includes all 4 that they've lost since John Tavares went down with his injury. I mean, the margins here are not that big. And yet, you know, for a team that, you know, is supposed to have gone through the grind in the last few seasons and, you know, learned a few things, I think that that's where some of the frustration builds. It's just not finding a way to execute near the end of the game to either preserve a lead or to find a way to get that next goal. And I think that you saw those instances last night. I mean, sure, Matthews gets beat coming out of the zone there by TJ Oshie on the tying goal, but, you know, he also went by William Nylander and then, you know, mm-hmm. walked right around Morgan Rielly, who, you know, we know isn't playing at 100%, but then, you know, got leaned on pretty heavily last night with more than 32 minutes because of Jake Muzzin leaving with his injury. But I mean, there's all kinds of time or opportunity on that play to have that not end up in the back of the net. You know, Mitch Marner's not an undisciplined player at all. I mean, someone who rarely takes penalties, but, you know, he was the one who caused the penalty shot in the overtime loss to Columbus a week or so ago. And then he takes that penalty last night that ultimately leads to Ovechkin's winner. I mean, these are the, you know, some of the main players on the team that I think are still going through the learning process. And so I don't know that there's a lot of individual frustration directed at those guys as much as there's just kind of a collective idea that, you know, they need to be a little bit sharper, because I think they've certainly played well enough, and I'm not making excuses, to have, you know, a few more wins than they do right now. And you know, a lot of the reason that they don't, you know, involves them looking in the mirror and just finding a way to keep their cool or to keep their heads on straight when it gets late in these games.
Chris, I want to ask you about Mike Babcock's postgame presser. Jeff prefaced before that you were there. His quote, and he had many, but a lot of them to the effect of, in talking about Alex Ovechkin's mm-hmm. quotes about the Leafs, Mike Babcock saying things like that always sting way more when it's right. I thought Mike Babcock was sort of kind of a psychological master yesterday, where sort of used Alex Ovechkin's comments to, I feel like, send a larger message externally. Did you read that as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, he also mentioned that he feels a little bit of embarrassment or shame. I can't remember which right. exact adjective he used, but, you know, because he's responsible for, you know, getting the team ready and getting them organized to where they're a little bit better. But, you know, I don't think he truly minded this coming at this point in time, you know, from someone like Alex Ovechkin. I mean, the beauty of the Ovechkin quote to me is that it's tough to interpret what he means. I mean, he said they have to play differently to win a cup, but you and I and Jeff might hear that and we might each conclude it, you know, what he means by differently. It's just gray enough where I think you can fill in, you know, what you want to see almost in what you believe the Leafs lack or what they need to do better to have a better shot at success. But, you know, I think that certainly Ovechkin has the credibility to say it. Obviously, you know, anyone who's paid attention the last 15 years understands what he had to go through to get to a point where, you know, he was challenged a lot and questioned and, you know, probably had people outright saying that the Capitals would never win a cup as long as he was their captain or as long as he was their best player. And, you know, after 13 seasons, they finally broke through in 2018. You know, this Leafs team, the best players or the core players are still very young, still relatively new in their careers compared to that kind of, you know, rise. And you know, I don't think that the Leafs coach minds them having to hear that come from someone as respected mm-hmm. as Ovechkin in the league and someone who's lived it. And, mm-hmm. and and sort of walked in those shoes. And so, yeah, it's a bit of, it can be taken, I think, as a bit of an indictment. You know, I don't really believe he was trying to take a pointed jab at them myself. I mean, again, it's just my read into the way he said it and you know, standing pretty nearby when he was giving that comment. You know, I think he just was being honest that he thinks there's still some learning the Leafs players to do. And in truth, you know, I think they all recognize that themselves. I mean, this organization hasn't won a playoff series since 2004. You know, all these guys have been here through the last three playoff losses and the last two against Boston. I mean, it's clear that they do have to kind of climb the mountain a little bit more than they have to this point before we're calling them, you know, a true Stanley Cup contender.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because hearing what Alexander Ovechkin said, even from a distance, Chris, I almost thought it was more a confession in a lot of ways. You know, like, hey, I went through this. You know, I that's what I took from it is, hey, this is my experience as opposed to him calling anybody out or anything like that.
Well, I mean, it's almost a compliment if you think about it. I mean, really, yep. What he's saying, I think, is that they have the kind of players that can do what he's done as well and have, you know, Hall of Fame type careers and win a Stanley Cup eventually. I mean, you know, we might be guilty of extrapolating a couple sentences of an interview too much, but I mean, I do think it can be, you know, it's almost a compliment that he's not saying, well, these guys haven't done anything yet. They're not on my level or they're not, you know, worthy of this, the talk that surrounds them. You know, I think he's saying that they have to learn to get there, but the unspoken part of that is that he thinks that they can get there and that yeah. It's something they can do if they choose to do what he did. So, you know, it just comes at a time where obviously it's been a bit of an uneasy October around this team. Everything hasn't fit in quite right. They've had the injuries. They've had new bodies. They've blown some games that they probably should have won. And, you know, when you make that comment kind of in that environment here in Toronto, obviously it's going to catch fire.
CJ, I want to just shift focus for a little bit here, and I want to ask you about Jim Gregory in a minute. But one of the things I found really interesting last night, a couple of plays involving Austin Matthews, and you've certainly seen more of him than I have. But I swear to God, I saw a couple of plays where it's almost like he was giving shooters a target, you know, in front of the net. And there were so many aspects to his game offensively that, you know, that I mean, there's so many layers to his game offensively that sometimes I think I almost get the impression it's going to be hard for Austin Matthews to ever sort of match that offensive level defensively. You know what I mean?
Right, and I think it's a little unrealistic to think he
exactly.
should, you know? I mean, I understand certainly why Mike Babcock's pushing him to make strides in that part of the game, and, you know, he's even said it himself that he thinks his biggest area of growth still needs to come defensively, but he has such offensive gifts that even in a league full of players, full of offensive gifts, I mean, I think he does things some people can't, and I'm talking the other top guys in the league. I mean, Connor McDavid said in an interview with David Amber prior to the season that the one player he wants to watch most in the league is Austin Matthews. I think it's because even, you know, the guys like McDavid who had, you know, 120 plus points last year and you know, has won scoring titles and been a league MVP, you know, he still does things that make a guy like him go, wow. And, you know, I think that tip you saw on the play with Tyson Barrie,
right.
You know, where clearly he was stretching his stick out. He was using his body to basically box out the defenseman, extending his stick to give a target to Tyson Barrie, and then the way he tipped it with his backhand. I mean, I'm not saying no one else could do that, but very few players could probably combine all that, you know, inside a three-second spot where he gets that positioning, calls for the pass, and then executes it right into the top corner. You know, that's a special thing. And you know, if you've watched Austin a lot over the years, you know, he very rarely scores what we would call a cheap goal. I mean, I feel like there's a lot of intent to what he does. It's not just, you know, shooting randomly and hoping. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's more, you know, the goal, if you saw the goal in Carolina last night where Svechnikov put the puck on a stick, sort of lacrosse style, Michigan style, and put it in the net. I mean, that's the sort of thing I expect you'll see Austin do too, because that seems to be one of the things he's worked on. And so, you know, offensively, he's at the very, very top of the NHL. I think that where he gets in those difficult matchups with the likes of Patrice Bergeron, and company around in the league, you know, those are tougher nights for him because he spends more time in his own zone. And that's where, you know, I think the growth can still happen in his game. But, you know, I don't think that we should ever expect him to be a Selke Trophy winner. He's got the gifts to be, you know, guy who wins for best defensive forward. And, you know, he's got a guy that can lead the league in goals at some point. And maybe even points. I mean, he just has such elite puck handling skills.
I did want to ask about Jim Gregory, former Leafs general manager, longtime hockey executive, passing away today. I mean, clearly Jim Gregory in a lot of people's thoughts. I've met Jim Gregory a couple of times, but man, he really was a presence in hockey, wasn't he?
Big time. I mean, you know, I've come around in my career after his days as Leafs GM and you know, when he was at the peak of his career and you know, right up until through the end of last season. I mean, a lot of times you'd see him around the games here in Toronto and in the meal room before the game or what have you. And just a real gentleman, you know, someone that had immense respect in the hockey world. He's in the Hockey Hall of Fame and, you know, had a real long, distinguished career in the league's hockey operations department after his time with the Leafs. So, you know, I'm sorry to hear about his passing. We had a running gag, kind of, and it's funny. I saw a few other writers tweet the same thing, but, you know, I always called him Mr. Gregory, and he'd always say, easy on the mister. It was always his. We had that running gag for about 10 years, so, and I just love that line. So literally every time I saw him, I'd always say, hi, Mr. Gregory, just to get that line back. So, you know, he'll be missed in the hockey world. He won't soon be forgotten, and, you know, he had a career that spanned generations, which, you know, I think is a testament to just, you know, the kind of man he was and the kind of person he was.
Yeah, it's really something when you can, you know, you can span generations and still kind of be considered current. Boy, that's really an art form, and that says a great deal about the person. CJ, always good to talk to you, my friend. Thanks so much.
All right, guys. Take care.
Thanks, CJ. Chris Johnson, senior hockey writer and insider with Sportsnet. And again, the next game for the Leafs is Saturday in Philadelphia against the Flyers. We will have that game on Sportsnet 590 CBC and Sportsnet Ontario. Leafs Nation pregame, Stellick and Alberg is 6:30. Hockey Central pregame, 6:30. Puck drops just after 7. Leafs Nation postgame with Stellick and Alberg right after the final horn at Sportsnet 590 The Fan. So a lot of time for Mike Babcock to work on the things he needs to work on. I guess there's don't have any clear indication yet as to whether John Tavares or Zach Hyman will be back on the weekend. John Tavares was practicing today. Morgan Riley given the day off for, I guess, a maintenance day. He looked really beaten up after the game yesterday. And Jake Muzzin.
A lot of minutes.
Jake Muzzin drilled into the boards by Tom Wilson. I don't know how I feel about the play. I mean, I think the reaction in the press box was twofold. One, anybody other than Tom Wilson's probably not a debate. Two, because it was Tom Wilson, do you have to view the hit differently?
Yeah.
But it was, anyhow, if you happen to see the play, Jake Muzzin went off the ice. It was pretty clear. It was pretty clear he was done for the night. Game 7 of the World Series. Nats and Astros goes at 8 o'clock tonight on Sportsnet 590. The Fan and Sportsnet special hour-long pre-game show at 7 o'clock. And God knows if any game needs an hour-long pre-game show, it's Game 7 of this series. Take an hour just to explain what happened in Game 6. Luckily, Justin Morneau, who is part of our World Series coverage and will be part of the pregame show, is going to join us in studio. He'll help us break down Game 6 and look ahead to a much-anticipated Game 7. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Subscribe to the Tim and Sid podcast with your favorite podcatcher, Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome back to Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360. We mentioned Game 7 of the World Series tonight. We'll have a one-hour-long pregame show on Sportsnet starting at 7. First pitch just after 8 on 590. And Sportsnet, Justin Morneau has been serving as one of our postseason analysts on Sportsnet. We're very pleased to be joined in studio by Justin Morneau. Justin, I was talking to you just when he came in, and I said, watching that play last night that everybody's talking about, the play at first base, my first reaction was thinking about everybody I've ever known who's playing first base, being in that position. I covered a game where Cliff Floyd essentially had his hand explode in that play. It's a tough play to make. Walk us through what would be going through a first baseman's mind in that play. And also, how did you see it? Like, when the play developed in real time, did you think that was the way it was going to be called?
I thought it was a bad throw. The first thing of the whole play is that I think it wasn't taken into account that it was just a bad throw. It would have hit the runner in the back mm-hmm. even if he was standing in foul territory because it had so much tail on it and it was, you know, running away from the first baseman. So it's like, do I, and that, no, and then I'll go on to, I don't agree with the rule. I think the rule's wrong. Mm-hmm. I don't think the rule, anything that's open for interpretation can be argued either way. You know, like we had this exact same play last year in the World Series.
Right.
Bellinger got hit in the back and it was called the opposite way.
That's right.
And it's a judgment call. And the umpire, if you're that umpire and you're watching that at full speed in roughly 4 to 4.5 seconds that happens, you're trailing that runner down the line. You see the ball, the throw coming in. You see the first baseman reach into the runner. You see his glove unable to make the play. And then you look down and you see his feet were maybe on the grass, maybe partially, but how are you supposed to hit the base if the base is in fair territory and you're supposed to run in foul territory? Like, to me, the rule doesn't make sense. Like,
no, I thought it was a correct call of a bad rule.
Yes, exactly.
Is the way to put it.
It was called right, even though we might not agree with the fact that it's a rule anyway. So what do you do? I mean, I don't know. You put the softball bases in there, the double base with the orange base on the side. I don't exactly. know. I mean, it's happened 2 years in a row on baseball's biggest stage. We had a delay of probably 10 minutes after this happened, even though it wasn't a play that could be protested or couldn't have been reviewed. So there was a lot of things going on there. And even though it got delayed and nobody knew what was going on, there was no explanation from the umpires mm-hmm. at Major League Baseball. And obviously they have a lot to do at that point. But is this good for the game to see this play 2 years in a row in the World Series and nobody has any idea what's going on, and we have to explain a rule down to a simple level to understand why it was called a certain way? So I don't know. I mean, I didn't like it. I think it was called the correct way, but I don't like the rule in the first place.
Justin, I just want to point out that between all of us on set, we have 4 All-Star appearances. I appreciate you, of course, coming through with that.
I've covered 7 of them.
Oh, that's good. The you threw me off there, boy.
I want to. That's a dick move. I apologize.
So, Justin, as someone who was in the game as long as you were, I want to get a sense from you about technology and how you think players either appreciate the idea of technology and getting calls correctly, even though they'll cause a delay in the game, versus whatever traditionalists think about part of the nuance of the game is, are umpires making correct calls and false calls? Where do you sort of stand on where we are in 20 or where we should be in 2019?
Well, I think the strike zone should be electronic. That's my
like a robot umpire.
I mean, it seems like we have the technology. It's how the umpires are graded. There's a box and, you know, their score is based on whether they call it inside the box or outside the box and everything else. If they trust it enough to grade the umpires on it, how do we not trust it enough to use it in the actual games? Now, I'm sure there's more. If you're telling me that $10 billion industry can't come up with some way to see if a ball goes over a plate that's in the same spot the entire time, we can't put some kind of sensors in the plate. We can't, I don't know. There's nothing that we can do to make it. I think it's just being delayed because everyone's trying to delay it as long as they can. I don't know. I think I agree with getting the calls right. I think that, like, you look at the first play of the game that was reviewed, infield single ends up being called out. If we don't have that, Washington loses that game. I mean, we're going back to that first play of the game over and over again, and we're blaming Jim Wolfe at first base when he's making a call in a stadium full of, you know, 48,000 people, as loud as it can be, and the pressure's on him to make the call right, and he ends up getting it wrong. But thankfully, we can go back and review that. Then he ends up coming around to score. Washington takes the lead. I mean, the game is completely different if that call stands and we don't have review. The thing, as a former player, the thing I would like about it is if we could stop blaming the players for the games taking so long. We've added these reviews. They take forever. The players aren't responsible for the pitching changes. That's where all the time comes from. So you're sitting here harping on players, and the players don't want this. The players want to be done in a game less than 3 hours, just as much as the fans and the TV networks do. You know, it's not like, but to sit here and say the players, it's all their fault because they're taking too long to get in and out of the batter's box. I don't agree with that either. So I don't know how much technology helps that, but
I just want one follow up, Justin. Do you think that the majority of the players think as you do, that they are at the point where they'd be good with an electronic umpire? Are you thinking is in the majority or no?
I think it's probably about 50-50 at this point. And I'm not sure pitchers will, most of the time the pitchers argue that they think it would be better for them. But I think if a hitter walked up to the plate and knew what the strike zone was every single time they walked up there, you would have an idea. There would be no complaining. And then the pitchers would get more pitches at the top of the zone and the bottom of the zone on breaking balls, because those are the hardest pitches for the umpires to call. But everybody would know. And then you could play within this set zone, because otherwise, what's the point of having the plate if sometimes a pitch that's an inch or two off the plate gets called a strike, and sometimes it gets called a ball.
Yeah.
The hitter's sitting there going, all right, what am I supposed to swing at here? I got a runner on third with less than two outs. He calls strike one a couple inches off the plate. If I want to get that runner in from third base, am I going to expand the zone, or am I going to stick with what I know is a strike? And you kind of go through this battle when you're standing in the batter's box mentally with yourself of going, all right, how am I going to get this runner in from third? He's established that this is the strike zone. All right, maybe he throws the same pitch, you call it a ball. And then the pitcher's out there going, you just called that a strike. It's the same pitch. And you're going through all this stuff that maybe is unnecessary if we just have a defined strike zone. But if we have an electronically defined strike zone, it's hard to argue with that stuff. And I don't know, it affects your at-bats.
Yeah, no, I was going to ask kind of a layman's question about that play at first base, too. It's something Buck Martinez mentioned that got me thinking about it. You know, he was saying that the way the game is played now with all the shifting going on, that you're requiring your infielders to move more during a game. You're requiring first baseman to move more. But the other thing I was wondering, because you touched on this, you mentioned the throw. And I've often wondered, when you're playing first base, a rushed play with the pitcher throwing the ball, do you have to approach that differently than if it's a quick play with the shortstop or third baseman throwing it because it's the pitcher? You know, a guy who's got throws three different pitches is all of a sudden throwing the ball. I presume he's going to throw a fastball to get it there. But do you have to play it differently when it's a pitcher than, let's say, if it's a third baseman making the throw or a shortstop making the throw?
Yeah, you do. I think Tom Kelly managed the Twins at two World Series titles. He was basically my personal first base coach when I started playing first base. I was drafted as a catcher. I moved over to first, and he said, especially with the pitchers, you have to be ready for a bad throw. Don't expect a good throw. He said, those guys, when they come off the mound, they're used to throwing downhill. All of a sudden, they're on flat ground. They have great arms, but some of them don't know where the ball's going, or some of them don't have the ability to not throw 90 miles an hour or 95 miles an hour. They feel like they have to take something off, and then the ball might do something they're not expecting. So always expect a bad throw from those guys. And then the distance between you and the pitcher is how much time you're going to have and how low you need to get ready to make a throw. So I don't know. It's one of those things where you go through that stuff in spring training. I always love doing those drills in spring training, the bunt plays and all the different, you know, you do your pitcher's fielding practice to get an idea of who can actually make a good throw, who throws it, hits you in the chest, and you pay attention during that stuff. So when they're out on the field in a big moment in the middle of a game, you know if it's a guy who has the ability to make a good throw, or if you're expecting a terrible throw, you're a little more mentally prepared for it.
If I'm watching the game tonight, Justin, understanding that so much, I think, of what's going to happen early is sort of Max Scherzer and where he stands in terms of health-wise. What will you be watching tonight? What for you will be a sort of an indicator of how things may go?
I don't know. I mean, Greinke, to me, is the real difference maker in this. Scherzer, if he's healthy and he can go out there, he'll give you everything he's got. You know, he's a guy that's going to grind and he'll battle. I think if he's healthy, he'll be able to dominate. If the only way he's going to come out of this game is if he's hurt, and I don't think he's going to give up five runs. Now, Greinke, on the other hand, I mean, he could go six or he could go two-thirds of an inning. You just never know. I mean, we were talking about it before. Yeah. Looking at him sitting in the dugout last night, it looked like he was a guy who hadn't slept in about 4 days and was indifferent to the fact that his team was in game six of the World Series. It was kind of like, all right, I'm here. I'm watching this game. I got a really
good
seat.
Maybe he's just calm, cool, and collected.
Yeah. I mean, he wants to appear that way. Yeah. You're hoping he's that way when he takes the mound tonight. But, I mean, it's going to be anybody's guess at what happens tonight. I don't know. I'm looking forward to seeing if they're able to contain the middle of the order and if they just have a plan to not let them beat you if you're Houston, which they did last night, and then just attack the bottom of the order. Because Gerrit Cole mentioned in his start after the game, I knew I had the bottom part of the lineup coming up. I wasn't going to give in to those guys. So there's an approach there. The thing that makes that effective or not is if you can keep Turner and Eaton off base. Mm-hmm. Then you have places to put those guys. If those guys are on base, then all of a sudden you're working yourself into trouble if you don't have anywhere to put Soto and Rendon. So I don't know. It's there's a lot going into this game tonight. It's going to be interesting to watch.
You a fan of carrying the bat to first base?
This is a tough one. I mean, I know as a player, I mean, I didn't like it.
Have you seen anybody do that?
No. I mean, you see guys about halfway, and then they see the ball go over the fence, or they realize that they're still carrying the bat. I think this is the thing that's hard for people to understand. When you're in a moment like that, and you have the amount of adrenaline going through your body of hitting a home run to put your team ahead in the World Series, you just kind of lose where you are sometimes. I mean, you kind of don't know if you black out, but you just kind of lose your senses a little bit. There's just this rush of adrenaline that takes over your body, and you feel like you're almost like you're floating as you're going. And then all of a sudden you catch yourself doing something maybe that you wouldn't have normally done. The problem is, I feel like Bregman kind of recognized that when he was about three quarters of the way down the first baseline.
And it's almost like, oh, what the hell?
And then he did something that was kind of funny. But I think the best way to look at it is, I think Altuve said something to him in the dugout, and it looked like it was almost like this moment that was supposed to lift their team and really get them going was almost like guys looking at each other going, what did he just do? What just happened? And it almost took away from the moment, and it kind of distracted. And I feel like it was one of those things that should have propelled them off of Strasburg and all these other things to score five or six more runs and everything else. And all of a sudden it was one of these moments that sort of took away from itself because he did that. So I don't know. I mean, I don't like it. I don't want to see kids doing it, but at the same time, you just get caught up in the moment sometimes. And that's what he said he did. And he apologized, but it might've been a little too late, because then it fired up Strasburg. It fired up the Nationals. Soto did it again as a little, you can do it, I can do it.
And then you had both managers kind of saying, that's not really us.
I think the thing that, I don't want to sound like somebody that doesn't want to be entertained and doesn't want to see stuff that, you know, because I was laughing when it happened. I kind of thought it was funny. The thing is, I think we just can't forget to respect our opponents. I think that's the biggest thing. If you don't want Strasburg jumping around the mound every time he strikes you out or every time he gets a big out and, you know, showing up the hitter is there has to be some type of mutual respect there. And if it's something that appears to be done out of disrespect or, you know, that's where I think the problem
lies. It was odd, too. And the fact that it was Alex Bregman doing, like, that's the thing. If it was, that's not his reputation, right? And so that makes it look almost worse. At least I don't think it's his reputation.
It appeared to be premeditated, like.
Right.
And that's, I think, what everyone has the problem with. Like, Batista, I had no problem with Batista.
Yeah.
Other than the fact that he stared in the dugout when he did it, but I don't know if that was intentional or not. But the fact that he just hit a huge home run and did that bat flip, I thought it was the emotion of the moment just took him over right there, and it happened. To me, Bregman is, it probably took him home run. He knew the ball was gone. Probably took him 6 seconds to get to first base.
Yeah.
So we'll give him 4 or 5 seconds of that to realize, to be up on the adrenaline surge and everything else. But all of a sudden, it looked like there was a moment there where he kind of figured out what he was doing, and then he just, I don't know what happened, but it was one of those things where
I'll finish it off.
Yeah.
How can you give listeners a sense of how taxing it is for some of these pitchers to potentially pitch on 2 days rest, 1 day rest? They're going to do it. Obviously it's the World Series, but like physically, how hard will that be if they're trying to get, let's say, one inning out of Cole or something like that?
I think, you know, the World Series, there's that adrenaline that takes over, but you also have to remember he had that same amount of adrenaline for, you know, the entire time he was out there in his last start. So I think John Smoltz said it, you know, really well. I don't know if it was game one or game two. He said 80 pitches in the World Series is like throwing 130 in a regular season game. I mean, there's just so much intensity. Every mistake is magnified. Every single pitch, there's just so much focus that goes into it. There's so much effort. So to be able to bounce back 2 days later on guys who really don't ever do it, it'll be interesting to see how he comes out. But I think once the adrenaline takes over, it just sort of that soreness. I mean, I was listening to Pedro Martinez talking about when he came in Cleveland. He was going through almost pitch by pitch of when he came in. He had a torn lat or whatever.
And he could barely lift his arm. It was cold.
And he started warming up and he thought, maybe I could do this. And then he pitched, I think, 4 innings after that to finish off Cleveland. It was one of those things, like he said, I think it was just the moment and the adrenaline and everything took over and the pain went away. And I'm sure maybe something else helped.
I was going to say,
pain, but you know, it's one of those things where
it's entirely possible.
He did it and you can do it. I mean, it's tough for those guys, but I don't know. I think Scherzer's probably going to be in more pain than I think Cole will if Cole comes in this game.
No, I thought it was, and I talked about this a little earlier too. I love Pedro at the end of the game yesterday. They had him talking to Juan Soto and they were all laughing about the play. And Pedro looked at him and said, just if it was me on the mound, you would have been wearing the ball the next at bat after that. And I just thought, that's Pedro. Yeah. Justin, thanks so much for doing this, man. Really enjoyed your work. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justin.
Justin Morneau. And again, 7 o'clock tonight, hour-long pregame show on Sportsnet ahead of game 7 of the World Series. We'll take a break, and then Mr. Deitch and myself will be back to put a bow on it. It's Writer's Block on 590 and 360.
Subscribe to the Scoreboard Podcast with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
A guilty pleasure, Deitch, I like on the radio.
Yeah. Tell them,
this is social distortion. Ring of Fire.
That's guilty pleasure. That's good. That's better than guilty pleasure. That's a cool version of Ring of Fire. Although the Johnny Cash version is great.
Do I have any reads I have to do? No, I don't. Okay, I've done all the reads. I was busy, quite excited about the. Oh no, I didn't. Damn it! Thank you, Travis. Oh, yeah, you can win a $200 Sportsnet Grill gift card every week with Sportsnet Grill Secrets. I'm apologizing to our friends at Sportsnet Grill. I was busy yapping, and I lost track of this. I know, I'm apologizing. I should have read this earlier. The only way to win is to subscribe to the weekly Sportsnet Nation newsletter. Go to sportsnet.ca/590 to sign up. This contest is open to Ontario residents only. I'm sorry about that. You know me, I'm all... Game 7, man. I'm ready.
I'm laying it. Ready. Where are you watching
game
7?
I'm ready to go. What?
Watching at home or here?
No, I'm going to the Raptors game.
Are you really?
I'm going to go to the Raptors game.
You've increased your...
Well, I want to write. See, the great thing about this time slot, there's several great things about it.
Yeah, the one big one is
the best thing about the time slot
is
I get to write again.
Yeah, which is nice. Are you writing off tonight's game?
I might. I'm trying to figure out...
You have that option, though, right?
I'm trying to figure out, Dwayne Casey fired, Mike Babcock might be... I might try to work some sort of a thing. Like, I just gave way.
Good thing about, writing for a website. Is essentially no deadline.
Yeah, no deadline. No
unless
limit,
it's
no
really,
limit,
really
no
newsworthy.
Limit on space, yeah, which is awesome.
That's one good thing about the web.
Anyhow,
everything else is probably.
So I will do that, and then I'll watch the game. I've got the MLB package, so I'll watch the game online.
So you'll be at the Raptors game, and then you'll
master.
Watch,
I'm a master of multitasking.
You'll watch MLB on your laptop.
Yeah. And then I'd
like to see the Raptors win tonight. I'd like to see them get to 4-1.
And then I'll.
I know it's early. I get it, but...
Well, 3-2, you're going to come on at 3-2 tomorrow and rip them?
4-1 sounds so much better than 3-2. It just does. It just does. Just aesthetically, it's not.
What?
It's cool, 4-1. Plus, they should beat the Pistons. They're a better team. Win at home.
Aesthetically, 4-1's better. What do you like?
You look at it on the standings. 4-1, just that feels like a dominant team. 3-2 is like, all right, a little over 500. Not bad. It's just the way you process those two records. If you're a fan, very different. You know what I'm saying?
No.
Travis is with me.
Don't even look at the standings. This is five games of standings are irrelevant.
It's early.
The standings don't even exist.
No, they exist. Every game counts.
No, they don't exist. The standings don't exist
But you don't want to throw away games in October.
The standings don't exist.
When do you start paying attention to standings in basketball? I agree. I give you. I give you. No one's looking.
Standings
down.
In basketball. When after do I start All-Star paying break? Attention? Around the All-Star break.
Okay, I buy that. That's fair.
Baseball probably
40 game mark.
No, later than that. Probably around the end of July.
And let me tell you why this is interesting. In football, you start paying attention week 3.
No, I never pay attention to football standings. I don't give a rat's ass about the NFL.
But generally speaking. Teams that go 0-3 are not making the playoffs. So if you're a football fan, you are paying attention to that third.
I just checked to see how the Vikings are doing, and then I see if Kirk Cousins is still standing upright. And if he is, then I don't watch it.
They've been better since you were complaining about them a couple weeks ago.
They still suck.
Yeah, they're not winning anything.
So who's going to win tonight? Come on. I know neither of us have a feel for this. Who's going to win Game 7? Travis, who's winning tonight? Pipe up, who's winning tonight?
Houston.
Picked Houston?
Pick score.
5-4?
Pick an MVP. No, I'm just kidding. So Houston's going to win 5-4.
I have no feel. I'm just going to go random Astros 5-3.
I picked the Astros over the Nationals at the start of the year.
I hope the Nationals win, though.
I don't have a rooting interest in this, but I'm going to go Astros. Travis, what did you say? What was your score? 5-4?
5-4, but let me change it.
No, I'm going to go. I got to go.
8-7.
8-7 Astros? All right. I'm going to go Astros 5-4.
Okay. I like that. And I do have a rooting interest because that organization tried to defame my ex-colleague. So I'd like to see the Nationals win. I'm not going to lie to the audience. I think the Astros.
All that karma stuff.
No, I don't buy karma. I agree.
Oh, karma stuff. That's over and done with. We'll be back tomorrow. We've all picked the Astros.
It's going to be a good show tomorrow. We got a lot of fun stuff to talk about.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. Danny Shulman will be along. Tim and Sid are next. They will have Jeff Passan. All Jeff Passan did on ESPN today is write maybe the best game story that I've read in the last 50 years or so.
Wow.
Yeah. As I said, I'm sick and tired of being a fanboy of a guy who's 25 years younger than me. Anyhow, Jeff Passan's next. Tim and Sid, watch the baseball. Enjoy the baseball. We'll see you manana.